Boy, things are slow tonight. He's trying to start. Yeah. I don't know, I'm froze up. Jen, can you do the drop down and click on Eye in the Sky, Alan Parsons? That'd be on uploaded files. It's not doing from my end.
Okay, I'll try. Alan, which one? Pie in the Sky, Eye in the Sky.
Eye in the Sky. No pie in the sky. Eye in the Sky.
Yeah, no, we'll try. It says click.
Turn the tables instead. Hi,
right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April 24th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. And our participant code is 449389. If anyone would like to email us a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find the banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance effort to save America. And also, anybody... we'll ask everybody if they can help support us by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. We brought this up a couple of weeks ago. We do have a new provider or actually a business partner as Ameriplan. Anybody who doesn't have a dental plan, and even if you have a medical plan, maybe you have a large spend down on that, this program might be helpful for you. Take a look at it. You can find their banner on the right-hand side, Ameriplan. Click on that, read up, watch the all the videos is about 2 or 3 minutes long, so they're short videos, but they're very informative. And so if you have some dental work that needs to be done and you want to get some really good prices, Ameriplan is the plan for you. Matter of fact, I think Ameriplan is better than any medical plan. You can control your own costs that way. But anyway, take a look. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, we're going to still in Matthew, we're in the Sermon on the Mount still. Matthew chapter, let's see what chapter we're in. Matthew chapter 7, we're going to be reading verses 21 through 29, so I'm dealing with about 10 verses. Matthew 7, verses 21 to 29. And the Lord said, "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of the Father shall he that doeth the will of the Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye workers of iniquity. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man that built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man that built his house upon the sand. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the wind blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. And it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes." Okay, again, that was Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 29, and this is still part of the Sermon on the Mount, which started on chapter 5. Okay, we don't have a particular topic. We do want to make the point we're trying to get into. Well, we're already in the courts, as everybody knows. We've put a lot of paperwork in already, a lot of foundational paperwork, you know. We did lots of memorandums. We've also alerted every level of government concerning subversion. And now it's time to go and prove and show the subversion against we the people, subversion against the United States of America, subversion against the Constitution. So we've got quite a few cases. We've got a couple of cases out west that everybody knows about, the new information has come up out west. Probably Robert's going to talk a little bit about that. But basically, you know, they did come out with a ruling. And you know, we'll talk about that after Robert talks, so I'm not going to get too much into that. He has more detail on that than I do, but I have an opinion and a thought about what the outcome of that was. But anyway, we're going to be filing papers on that judge out there, also the judge up there in Oregon that has made some decisions. We're going to be filing some papers up there also against those judges. We're going to start working on, and we've got a few other cases that we're working on to get into the courts. We also want to go after the judge in the Hammond case. We also want to go after the judge in the Joe White Robinson case. We also have about 30 judges that we want to go after that have refused to give the people the due process by ignoring habeas corpus. We're going after the clerk up in Albany that required us to give them $400 in order to file a case. We've already filed the papers of a default on that clerk already, and we're going to be pushing that a little harder. We're going to be going after the judge. Very shortly, the judge in our case is going to become a defendant. We're going to send him one other letter to let him know that what he needs to do. We've already given him a command to write the default and to pursue that default, and he hasn't done it yet, but we'll give him a little more time. By the time we get all these other papers together, which I think will take us 2 or 3 weeks maybe, I'm not sure how much time it's going to take, but it's a lot of paperwork. And but when we file all that paperwork, if this judge has not responded by then we're going to make this judge a defendant, and we can get ourselves another judge up here in Albany. We want these people to know we mean business. So we got a lot of papers to be filing and a lot of work. We also are mounting up quite a few non-judicial foreclosures, which, again, all these cases prove conspiracy. The fact that they're consistent from one state to another state, from a county to a county, they're all doing the same thing. We also have been unable, and we're going to make this point very clear, we've been unable to find one Article III court in America, not one, although we have opened one in Albany, New York, and we will not allow that to become anything less than what the Constitution says it is. And we will go after the president himself, even if he turns against us. And you know, if the president can't understand what's going on, he needs to educate himself. But he is an educated man. I think he understands. We do see that he's made a few errors, but he's done a pretty good job, and we're going to have to educate him in a few places. It's just a matter of lack of understanding. But the president needs to really bone up on the common law. We're doing the best we can to give him all the information he needs to have. We're giving him plenty of information on all of the paperwork we're writing. We've given lots and lots of footnotes to explain and express everything, so he should understand it. Being that he's not a lawyer, it'll be a lot easier for him to understand it than it will be for the attorney general. I do think that the attorney general might be a problem for us because he's a lawyer, and we listen to and see some of the things he's doing. He's totally bar. But you know what? When we lay this out to him and we expect him to give us a prosecutor to start prosecuting these cases here in Albany, which is going across the United States of America, when we start this process, if he doesn't come forward, we're going to start pressing on the president to get rid of this guy, because the president promised that he wanted to be lawful. He was going to get a lawful, someone who will uphold the law, that he would get a good attorney general. He claims that this guy's a good attorney general. And when he finds out that he's not, he needs to fire him and put someone else in his place. We'll suggest to him to find someone who's not a bar lawyer, because bar lawyers are a problem. They've got this. They got this thing about the common law and the people being able to rule themselves, run our judiciary and run our political process. And running the judiciary, I mean, ultimately running the process of the juries, the grand juries, and whether they be a grand jury or a petty jury, a trial jury. But we have government by consent, and that's where we consent, and we need to have that power back. It doesn't belong to the elected officials. It doesn't belong to the attorney general. It doesn't belong to the judges. It doesn't belong to any elected or appointed individuals. It belongs to us, we the people. Now, again, you know, this is our task, and we are trying to organize and getting everybody involved. We've got over 6,000 members. We've got 1,000 administrators, over 1,000 administrators. We have about 1,200, I think, county organizers. We've got, I forget how many state coordinators. You know, you can read the right side of our website. We have the listings of all the members that we have in our organization here. But we have quite a few people involved with us, and we're coming together on Mondays at 8 p.m. for a board meeting, which we're pulling all the people that are active and doing something to help organize to come together for that organizing at 8 p.m. every Monday. So anybody who would like to volunteer in that as a state coordinator or a county organizer or even district leaders or whatever position you want, we need people at all levels. But we have to organize the people. We have to get active, really active now, because in 2 or 3 weeks, when we file all these papers, we need the people behind us. We indeed have to be we the people. So we need people to be active. Everyone should be putting in at least 1 hour a week. Everyone can volunteer 1 hour a week. Everyone can do that. Some people can volunteer almost full-time. Matter of fact, we have quite a few people who volunteer full-time. A lot of people who are retired or disabled that are full-time here. And that's what keeps us going. But we need everybody to give us 1 hour. And if you want to know what you need to do, what you can do, and you're not sure, you know, there's lots to do. It's your choice on what you want to do. We have all kinds of committees, and we have all kinds of organization levels. Just give a call to Jan, and all the Jan. You'll find them under the directory, and work out to see what you can do to help out. Everyone should be given $5 a month. Everyone. $5 a month is not going to break you. I mean, I know that some people are really on a very, very, hardcore budget. Maybe they're on Social Security and they're making very much and they're barely surviving and they can't give $5 a month. We appreciate that. But most everyone else can give $5 a month. So please, we do need that support. Imagine what we could do with $5 a month. 6,000 members giving $5 a month. That's $30,000 a month. We literally could start maybe hiring some people on a full-time or part-time basis in every single state, you know, for the high-level structure of really getting down to business of working out the organization and working out the necessary things that need to be done in order to really organize this organization that we've put together. We try to refer to us as an assembly, but we are organizing, we are communicating, and we're trying to be consistent in the things we're doing. So we are an organization of some type, but really we're an assembly of people trying to take our nation back. And as I mentioned earlier, there are no Article III courts out there. Not one. I haven't seen one yet. Every judge we've gone up to, every court that we filed any papers to, have not responded appropriately. None of them. Even Congress has not responded appropriately. None of them. And we have sent papers to every both houses on a federal level, both houses on every single state level. Every single state judge in this nation, every single federal judge in this nation, we have sent papers to all of those people and more. But at all state level and the federal level, everybody has gotten copies of our papers. We've put out about, goodness, I think it was 16 or so papers that they all got copies of. We have been copying the president, everything we're doing, and we're about ready when we file all these papers in the court in the next couple of weeks. We're going to get a complete copy of everything up to the attorney general and require and expect him to give us to talk to the U.S. attorney down here in New York and make sure he contacts us to work with us because we got a lot of indicting to do. Now, of course, we can't say we're going to get people indicted. We're going to bring them up to be for indictment because we haven't indicted anyone yet. Although we have indicted some people 2 years ago, and that's kind of sitting out there. We'll need to reactivate all that. We went after all of the administrative judges of New York. I think there's 9 of them. They're the leadership of the entire state, and they are operating, a criminal organization is what they're really operating. RICO on steroids here in New York. And I'm sure it's like that in every state of the union also, unfortunately. But anyway, we want U.S. attorneys that's going to start prosecuting these cases because we got a lot of cases to go after. We got subversion against the people. There is a conspiracy against the common law. They have just ignored the law and have put something else in its place. And Congress has been compliant with this, for after all, they've been writing these silly laws. Actually, they haven't been writing them. Someone else has been writing them and sending them to Congress and telling Congress to pass them, and they pass them without even reading them. You know what? If you don't have time to read them, how about not passing them? And besides that, we gave Congress the power and the authority to write law. We didn't give the elites the New World Order or some other bar attorneys or someone else to write the law. We didn't give them the power and the authority to write the law. We gave that to Congress, elected individuals, and yet they don't even do that. Again, their laws come from outside. Who knows who writes these things? Anyway, more conspiracy, more subversion, more problems. And all we need to do is get into the courts where the people have the power and the authority in the courts. And game over for them. Very quickly, we will move through this nation with indictments. Either they'll obey the law, or we will indict them and put them in the jails that they built for us. I think it's that simple. All right, anyway, that's where we're at. So we do need as much help as possible. Please volunteer 1 hour a week or more. You know, if you can give more time, fine. But some people, you know, can give quite a few hours a week. And again, some people are retired or disabled, and they can give more. But we do need that. And please give us the $5 a week or more, because we need to pay for all of this paper and ink and all the work we have to do here. We have a lot of papers to file, so you know, we can use whatever you can send. Okay, is Gerard here? All right, before we move over to see what's going on, are there any questions out there, Jen?
Yes, I have two this evening. The first one is in Treatise on the Law of Sheriffs by Walter Anderson. When the state statute makes the sheriff liable for an escape of a prisoner, the United States may sue the sheriff in such cases for escape of a federal prisoner. State versus Hill, Supra. How can a county sheriff be liable for the escape of a federal prisoner?
Well, that's not the law. What court made that decision?
Does not say. It just says State versus Hill.
Super. Yeah, clearly that's not a United States decision to begin with, and it's just a federal district court. You know, look, when I first started studying law and trying to figure out how to do things and how to write papers, and I would start, you know, pulling up cases, this case against that case, use it as a precedent or an example, try to show that the case is similar and it should be decided this way, and all that is a bunch of BS. It's nothing but a bunch of BS. It doesn't belong there, okay? If you got a United States Supreme Court decision, okay, from the United States Supreme Court, that you could take with at least a grain of salt, you know? You could take that and use that, and they got a lot of good decisions, and we can utilize that. But they have some bad ones, too. We're going to ignore those, and we'll override those. Remember, look at the United States Supreme Court has final say in equity courts. They do not have any say in courts of record. Courts of record are final. That's we the people. We have the final word. That should tell the power and the authority of the people. When a jury makes a decision, it is final. The United States Supreme Court cannot even overturn that decision. The only thing they can do is if in that decision somehow someone else's unalienable rights were affected in some way, they can deal with that problem. Other than that, the decision is final. And so the United States Supreme Court isn't the final sayer of the law. It really is the people. And remember, they're an appellate system for the equity court. In other words, where a judge makes the ruling in equity, okay? You go into court, you have a contract dispute. You know, you have the option of requesting a trial by jury if it's over $20, but if you don't want to do that, you can use the, you know, the judge system, the equity court. It'll move a lot quicker. At least it should. It doesn't because they like to make money, like they make to get the bar attorneys making money. We got to do something about that. You know, all these stupid, silly hearings. It's just worthless. But in any event, you know, some hearings are necessary in an equity court, and they have to put things together and get everything ready for the actual trial, which is really all on paper, or generally should be all on paper. The judge doesn't need to sit down and really hear a case argued in an equity system because it's all on paper to begin with. You know, it still goes all on paper anyway and is actually battled out before the jury hears it. And then they bring it before the court, before the jury, for the case to be unfolded. And the jury makes the decision. But the United States Supreme Court can overrule anything on an equity court. In other words, what another judge, a decision another judge makes. But the United States Supreme Court cannot overrule anything a court of record makes, where the people are the jury. And obviously that's even clearer in the federal level, all these different decisions that these courts make, you know, they're not there to make the law. We're not there to lean on them. They're there to follow American jurisprudence. That's what they're for. We already know who wins and who loses those cases just by reading the paperwork if they did it honestly. Because you have to follow American jurisprudence. There's a process to be followed. And then there, of course, is the agreements made between the people. It's generally contract law. Usually it's, you know, people are arguing over a contract or some dispute some kind. Generally, that's what equity court is. And no criminal court is held in equity. So I don't know how this judge can make such a ruling on anything criminal. Anything that has to do with they think that the jury is going to be obedient to them or something, that's insane. But if there is a judge, if there is do you know, have any more information on this, Jan? I mean, is this just a ruling that was made? Has it affected any sheriffs?
It does not say any more than that, so I do not have a clue. Can't
if
help
there
you.
Is a sheriff out there that is being affected by this decision, we would love to help that sheriff. So if anybody knows of that sheriff, of a sheriff being affected by that kind of a ruling, okay, and would like our help, we are more than happy to help that sheriff and bring their case into our case as part of subversion. You can't put that kind of a restriction on a sheriff. You can't make the sheriff responsible for that kind of a thing. And it sounded like they were in federal custody, and if they escape, is that what it's saying?
Well, it just said escape of a federal prisoner, apparently in the sheriff's
jail.
So
federal, in the sheriff's custody.
Well, okay. It just says when the state statute makes the sheriff liable for an escape of a prisoner, and it doesn't say state, federal, local, the United States may sue the sheriff in such cases for escape of a federal prisoner.
Well, you know, look at it's probably the case where a federal prisoner is being held in a county jail, held by the sheriff. And, I mean, how often would a person escape that anyway? I mean, I got to believe that's pretty rare, you know.
Maybe El Chapo.
But okay. Anyway, if there is a sheriff out there that's in trouble with that kind of a thing, if anybody knows and they're interested in us helping, we'll help. Anything else?
I have another brief one. Can you expand on this charter that you say judges follow when they should be following the Constitution, and where did this charter originate?
Well, again, you're talking about jurisdictions unknown. I know I'm talking with Gerard, and he's investigating something which, you know, he thinks that a lot of judges are really responding under. And I found some other stuff that's very interesting, that if they are responding under something else, there is a statute requiring any elected official that has any that is being held in some way that they have to honor a foreign authority or something of that nature, that every so often they have to file concerning that the nature of that you know, responsibility they have towards a foreign agent, and also give record of any of their decisions that were affected by that, to make sure that there is no contradiction or a conflict of interest in what they're doing. And if Gerard is right, and again, I'll be talking with him about this week, because I'd like to pull this into the case. If he is correct, and all these judges are falling under a particular kind of a charter that's out there, and they've given their allegiance to them, and they haven't been reporting, that in itself is a crime and misbehavior. So that becomes another problem for all these judges. But somewhere, these judges do have a sworn or has given themselves over to some authority that they're following over and above the Constitution. That has become clear just by listening to the UN. Well, this is, I think that's what Gerard's looking into. But there's also, there's other things. There's the, what is it, the Judiciary Act, the Organic Act of 1871. That's where a lot of this stuff seems to have started. It actually started, some of it stemmed right out of the Judiciary Act of 1789. But the 1871, I don't know if I said 1771, but it's 1871 for the Organic Act. And then there are some other acts that have taken place that they've built upon that. And there's quite a bit of legislature that has built upon all that, that has taken these judges in a different direction. And I even with that, when you go to study and look at this stuff, you kind of get confused. Hang on, I got to change my headset because this one's about to go out. Give me a minute. Okay, testing. Am I coming through now? I had to change my headset.
Yep, you sound fine.
Testing 1, 2. I'm good. Okay. Let me think where I was at here. The jurisdiction. I'd rather say jurisdiction unknown. Because I don't know what it is. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. That's what I think. They're settling accounts on at a maritime level, at sea, bringing things into port. They, if you look at the federal rules, they have the in rem process weaved all the way through all the rules, and a very very. Very tricky the way they word some of these things, and they bring it out from, the law at sea, right into the law of the land. And so there's a mixture there somehow of some of the things, because they're dealing with us as chattel, okay? And they come out after us in rem. They come out after, the IRS comes out after you in rem. That's an act at sea, not on land. It's not permitted on land. That is to go after the an item and not the person. You know, on land you have to go after the person to get the item. You can't go after the item and not the person. But they take your land. The tax foreclosures are done in rem. IRS collections are done in rem. Just about any time the government comes out after any of the people to take something away from them, it's done in rem. Okay, and that is maritime law. Where, you know, you go after, for instance, you have the prize of the ship. If you chase some pirates and you seize their ship and you bring it into port and you file the papers in rem. Now, even there, there's required two papers that need to be filed a proof of claim and fiduciary authority. Okay, both of those papers need to be filed. And that's why even in the cases where the IRS comes out after people, or if the tax people come out after you, you know, for tax foreclosure, they also have to file these papers in a federal court system because it's a federal item. And before they can take the property away from you on the county level, or would usually take done on the county level, you know, the states, the towns come together with the villages and so on and so forth, and they bring these cases together and they take it away on a county level. So they have to still file in the federal district court of that county those two papers, which gives them fiduciary authority and a proof of claim before they can go forward. And they're going after the item, not the person, where, again, on the law of the land requires you, people due process. You can't touch people's property. That's the extension of them. You know, you have to go after the person, give them due process, and then for after that point, you can take property if the jury goes that way. But, you know, this whole system of where, you know, what they're acting as is the big question. I have no idea what kind of law they're bringing in. As far as I'm concerned, it's jurisdictions unknown. Because now you have the UN Charter, and that has allowed judges to go a certain direction. And you got this and that. And a charter is just really, you know, it's a corporate charter is really the rules and sort of the way a corporation is going to act. And anybody who owes allegiance to that particular you know, corporation or entity or whatever you want to call it, then they have to, usually they'll take an oath or something, but then there's conflict of oaths. If you take an oath on a foreign entity and then you take an oath to obey the Constitution and execute its laws as a judge, boy, that's a real big conflict of interest. And that's where the problem is. So I will call it jurisdictions unknown. Gerard, you sound like Donald Duck. You might have to reboot. You're going to have to go reboot. You sound like Donald Duck. Get off the phone. Go reboot. Okay, you heard him sound like Donald Duck or something, right, Jen?
Right, yeah. I couldn't understand a word he said. could you say a word or two about jurisprudence? That's another question I had.
Well, American jurisprudence ultimately is really the principles of common law. And, you know, look at the United States Supreme Court has made a lot of rulings, and a lot of that has come together under jurisprudence, and it's called American jurisprudence. But also, you know, things that have been in the common law courts for centuries. You know, you can go into Black's Law and things that are you know, logical and work with proper conclusions and justice. And you can read about this in American Jurisprudence, which, by the way, is almost an impossible book to get. You know, the American Jurisprudence on its own. But these judges are supposed to... Someone's not muted here. We're getting sounds coming over.
No, I took care of it.
Anyway, these judges are supposed to be acting under American jurisprudence, which gives them directions and gives them the solutions to how they are to rule. I think next week what I'll do is I'll maybe look in. I can't pull it off right now, but maybe next week we'll talk a little bit about American jurisprudence and we'll read out of American jurisprudence some of the decisions, the way these judges are to act. But look, it's all about what is right and wrong. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. And the heart of man knows what's right and they know what's wrong. I mean, there are a few exceptions to that. But basically, you know, God's law is written in the hearts of men. And that's why the jury system is so such a good system, because you get people listening to the stories and then talking about it and trying to figure it out. And generally, they will figure it out. Okay, you know, you can look at a court case and you can read, you know, what the facts are on a court case. Just look at the facts, and you read through it, And logic will tell you who's right and who's wrong. You could see who broke the contract. You could see who broke the deal. You could see who did the wrongdoing just by looking at the evidence. Okay? And that's how a judge is supposed to go through the process. They're supposed to look at the evidence, and they're supposed to rule on the evidence. It should be clear to them who is right and who is wrong. And if they make a mistake, there's an appeal system. There's the appellate system, the Court of Appeals, and so on. And so you can appeal it up the line at least to a certain level. And if when you get to the highest level, they still agree that this was a proper conclusion, then it probably was a proper conclusion as long as we're not in jurisdictions unknown. These judges are operating in jurisdiction and making decisions that are beneficiary to someone else that's not even included in the court case, okay? And these people are benefiting from them. And the judges are selling their souls in that process in order to have these people benefit. But anyway, jurisprudence is a process. It's a science. And let's look a little more. I don't want to really speak too much, but I'd rather read about it and pull some verses out of American jurisprudence, which talks about it as a science. Matter of fact, when Brent comes on, maybe he'll talk a little bit about it. And this is how they're supposed to be ruling.
I want to supplement some of what you said, John.
Go right ahead. Now you don't sound like Donald Duck anymore. Go ahead.
As far as these judges go and this charter that they're following, I have not gotten to the point where I see anything about them taking an oath to it. However, you know what they do today. They put a policy in or they follow a charter, and they don't take an oath to it. They just do it. And because it's in writing, everybody thinks it's okay. You know what I mean? So it's like when we went to pick up that guy's guns at the sheriff's department. They said, oh, no, you have to apply for this. And I said, who says? They said, well, the county attorney put in a policy. I said, that's not law. That's a policy. Law, I said, that's illegal. It's against the Second Amendment, and her policy doesn't trump law. Well, anyway, they gave us the guns, but that's what they do. They break the law until somebody holds their feet to the fire. So everybody ignores it. Everybody's dumbed down, so nobody questions it. So what they have is they have this charter that they've been trained to that says it's their law, their court, and they have independence, judicial independence. And they even have something in there that says a judge has a right to belong to a private organization. Well, lo and behold, who's running the prisons? Private organizations. And who's part of that private organization? See, it gets worse as you go along. They are. They're feeding the own prisons that they're part of. And this is a fact. So not only do you have a judge that's violating his oath and everything else he's doing, but he's making money on his decisions. I mean, what could be more outside of the law than that? I mean, it's so dirty and so disgusting, I can't believe what I'm hearing, and that they're getting away with this and that nobody's doing anything. That it could be that dirty and that deep, but that's what it looks like to me. I mean, that's definitely what's going on here as far as, and I mean, when you hear a judge quote word for word out of the document, the UN document that was drafted 30-something years ago, and the same words are coming out of that particular judge's mouth as what's in that document, I have no doubt that she's following it. She's reading like from a playbook. And now this is, don't forget, they've been doing this since the 70s. So this is very deep-seated and deep-rooted, and they've gotten away with more and more and more and more and more, and this is why they're so confident that they'll just keep getting away with it. Because they got the court so locked down, and it says in there that it's up to the judge to decide what gets tried and what doesn't get tried. I mean, if you read the document, you'll fall on the floor. It goes against everything in the Constitution. It's very easy to knock it down with the Constitution, but I just wanted to add how, you know, they're following this plan that probably the guy that put them in there was following. So it's, you know, we're probably already two generations into this corruption, and that's why it's so bad. And they probably think it's perfectly fine, you know, and so they follow that charter, and they run you down the road, and they tell you all these things because they've been taught that that's their job, and that they are the basically the dictators. that nobody comes above them and nobody can tell them what to do. And they've been trained that way, and the guys that trained them that way. So it's a big fight, because I think some of them are actually ignorant to what the law is. They don't know the Constitution. They don't know it. You know, maybe they go over cursory, you know, for the blatant things, so that they have some kind of excuse that allows them to sleep at night or allows them to put people off that don't know any better. But if you know the Constitution, you could go in there and blow any of these judges away, and they can't answer you. If you went in and questioned them and said, are you operating under a charter when you say that? Do you believe that you have the right to do that because you're answering to a international association? And it is a private association, because you and I can't get into it, can we? Otherwise, we would, right? So anyway, I just wanted to clarify and maybe put a little bit more light on what's going on with this thing. Now, I don't know if they take it, but look at when you have, like John just said, John, you hit it on the head. I can't believe you went there. That when you have a corporate charter, there's things in there that you're expected to do. So it's like you're swearing to do it, right? I mean, so that is an allegiance to something foreign. And I mean, I don't think that they can join a private association like that, judges, because judges are supposed to be apolitical and neutral and all that stuff. And guess what?
They can't even belong to the Bar Association, and they do.
Well, isn't the Democrat and Republican parties a private association? Isn't that what we learned when we were suing them?
Well, at this point, they are private associations until we take them back and make them what they should be,
right,
political.
Right. So a judge can't be part of a private association, because if a judge has a right to be part of a private association, then that means that he could be in the Republican or Democrat Party as a operative or a leader or whatever. So it doesn't even make sense. This stupid charter that they have, this document they have, if you put it up against logic and law, it falls on its face 10 times over. It's not even written very well. So this is why we want people to take the Constitution courses, because if you take that Constitution course and you know the Constitution and you know what each, you know, section is, and then you go through this, and you go, ha, that can't be. That violates this section. You know what I'm saying? It's that bad. And it's that easy to rip it apart. And I mean, if a judge is questioned on that, how's he going to answer that? The Constitution says one thing, and he's doing another thing, and he's saying another thing, completely outside of that Constitution. And, you know, this is why we need to do this now, because right now the Constitution's in effect. They can get rid of the Constitution, these guys are just going to continue and get worse. I mean, they are already a dictatorship right now. Look, they told the president, you can't have a travel ban. Well, that's total dog doo-doo. And he could have said, guess what? Yes, I can. But he didn't. He played a game with them.
He should have nullified.
He should have, and I'm not exactly sure why he didn't. I don't know.
I don't think he knew, but he knows now, I think.
Well, or either that, or he wanted to keep them busy with this crap. Well, they were going, look, he turned right around, and he rewrote it in different words, and yet didn't pull the case so they could keep working on it. I think he's keeping them busy with their own crap. They throw stuff at him, and he puts his plate right under their nose. He says, okay, let's eat on this for a while. And that's what they're doing. He's still got that stupid case in court. It is no case. We just blew it out of the water. We would dismiss it, John, right? But yet they're still chewing on it. And he stuck it under their nose so they could chew on it. And then he turned around, and he rewrote the executive order using different language and put it back in, so they have to put that one in court too. But they didn't dare do that now, did they? So he played their game. He kept them chewing on that one, and he put the other one in. So I think he does know what he's doing. So I don't know.
All right, we'll see what happens. You know, he's going to have to be doing some strong things soon once we file these next sets of papers. You know, let me respond a little bit back, because I had a little time to look up a few things on jurisprudence.
Okay.
And here is the definition of jurisprudence. It is the science of the law. By science here is understood that connection of truths which is founded on principles either evident in themselves or capable of demonstration, a collection of truths of the same kind arranged in a methodical order. In a more confined sense, jurisprudence is the practical science of giving a wise interpretation to the laws and making a just application of them to all cases as they arise. In this sense, it is the habit of judging the same question in the same manner and by this course of judgment forming precedents. Now, these precedents are, you know, really end up being, you know, they have to come to a point where they really is a self-evident truth. You know, you just because a judge made a decision and they call and it's a bad decision, you can't call that a precedent. Yet they do. And that's why I never, ever, at least not anymore, I used to years ago, but I never, ever quote any federal district court decision or any state court decision. The only ones I will quote is the United States Supreme Court. That's the only one. And they're pretty rock solid. As a matter of fact, American jurisprudence is pretty much made of up of a lot of the decisions from the United States Supreme Court. Now here, this is from the 16th American Jurisprudence, second edition, section 177. And by the way, you know, in my total ignorance, trying to buy a book called American Jurisprudence, I bought a book. And I didn't realize how many sections of the book and how distorted they have made it. And I got a book on American jurisprudence on tax law. There is no such thing as American jurisprudence on tax law. It doesn't exist. Yet they've already bastardized even our American jurisprudence by adding things that shouldn't be there. Okay? But here, this is from the American jurisprudence 16th. And it says here, the general misconception is that any statute passed by legislators bearing the appearance of law constitutes the law of the land. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and any statute to be valid must be in agreement. It is impossible for both the Constitution and a law violating it to be valid. One must prevail. This is succinctly stated as follows. The general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffected for any purpose since unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment and not merely from the date of the decision so branding it. As unconstitutional law in legal contemplation is as inoperative as if it had never been passed, such a statute leaves the question that it purports to settle, just as it would be had the statute not been enacted. Since an unconstitutional law is void, the general principle must follow that it imposes no duties, it confers no rights, it creates no office, it bestows no power or authority on anyone, it affords no protection, and justifies no acts performed under it. A void act cannot be legally consistent with a valid one. An unconstitutional law cannot operate to supersede any existing valid law. Indeed, insofar as a statute runs counter to the fundamental laws of the land, it is superseded thereby. No one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. Any court, government officer who acts in violation of, in opposition or contradiction to the foregoing by his or her own actions commits treason and invokes the self-executing sections of 3, 4, and the 14th Amendment and vacates his or her office. It is the duty of every lawful American citizen to oppose all enemies of this nation, foreign and domestic. That is American jurisprudence. And you can find that in the 16th American Jurisprudence, second edition, section 177. Now, what this really lays out the law so beautifully in itself. I mean, it doesn't need to go any further.
I got to say one thing. Why do we still have the SAFE Act after what you just read? Anyway,
well,
go
exactly,
ahead.
Why do we have anything? Look at this is so perfect. Here is the genius of our founding fathers. When many of the states refused to sign the Constitution without a Bill of Rights or a Bill of Prohibition, whatever you want to call it, okay, that bill that came up 2 years after the Constitution was signed, or was it three? It was two years, I think, 1791. I think is when the Bill of Rights was signed, okay? Well, just think of the genius of that small piece of paper with then 10 amendments to the Constitution, which is part and parcel to the Constitution. It's not just an amendment to the Constitution, it's part and parcel to it. You read it, it lays that out very clearly, that this had been anticipated before the signing, that this would be part of the Constitution. And what it was a bill of prohibitions. You can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do that. Okay? And it is genius in the sense of what it really focused in on. You know, our basic, fundamental, unalienable rights. You know, the right of free speech, the right of freedom of religion, the right of the Second Amendment to bear arms, to be part of a militia, and so on. All of these, the Fifth Amendment, the right of due process, the right of common law courts, all of this is in the Bill of Rights. Now, when you take the Bill of Rights and anything that any legislature can possibly come up with, if you lay the Bill of Rights alongside it and say it violates it right here, it makes that law null and void. But these judges refuse to bend. They refuse to back off. They refuse to acknowledge. They refuse to obey the Constitution. And that is our battle. And we will win this battle in a battle on logic. Okay? We can because the president is not a lawyer, we can convince him a lot easier than we can any bar attorney. Bar attorneys are really, they got these problems, I call them psychological problems, to be honest with you. I can't think of anything else because, look, when you have a psychological problem, something happened usually in a younger age, maybe it was traumatic or something oddball happened, and you put this oddball thought into a conclusion in such a way that affects your thinking, and that's called a psychological problem. Some people, there could be, you know, really very serious problems, and generally, you know, everybody has some psychological problems. They misunderstood something, and they can fix them pretty easily just by, undermining, you know, discovering what that misconnection was, okay? Well, this is the case with lawyers, in my opinion, because I talk to so many lawyers, and it's like talking to a wall. You might as well talk to the wall. Because you're not going to get anywhere with these people. It's like they just can't get past first base. They just can't follow along. That's because they have these conclusions that were drilled in them under the Bar Association's teachings. They were drilled in them so strong, and it sets a certain kind of an oddball logic, and they can't see the true logic at all. They can't understand.
Their perception has been cauterized. Their schooling has cauterized
psychologically,
their perception.
They got a psychological problem, no matter how you
that's
put
right.
it. Yes, that's a good
right.
way to put it, though, but it's right. a psychological problem, no matter how you go. And, you know, after all, they spent all this time and all this money to get this law degree. After all, they got to be right and you got to be wrong. After all, I learned this in school. Well, you know, the Bar Association is guilty of subversion, teaching subversion. Against the Constitution, they teach that that the common law has been abrogated, and that it's not to be held anymore. It violates every single one of the Bill of Rights, every single one of them, and that's what we're up against, and that's what we got to battle. But you know, we can build this case in courts, and we can win these cases, but only if the people are behind us, and we have to take down anybody who gets in our way. We are about to take the judge down that is ruling on this case because we have given him an order of ruling, okay? We've given him the authority, an order of a ruling through default on the clerk who has defaulted, and there is a process, and we have ordered the judge to go through that process. We're not going to go to the clerk. We want the judge, the administrator of this court, to do what he has to do, his due process. He has to do what is his duty. And he has to write the default and execute it. And he hasn't done it yet. Now, I think we only wrote this up about a week and a half ago, so we're going to give him more time. We're going to give him two or three more weeks. And right after we file the next series of papers, That's when we're going to go after this judge. Because if he hasn't made a ruling by then, we'll give him one more opportunity. We'll give him a three-day notice. And if he doesn't, he's going to become a defendant in this case. And he's going to have to come and show cause by what authority he thinks he could deny the lawmakers of this nation, which is we the people. These are our courts. We control them, not them. This is a court of record. And we truly are the people. We're not the prosecutors, people. We are the people. We're coming in with valid arguments, valid cases. They cannot argue it. They cannot deny it. It's just bold face right there. And there's nothing they could do about it. There's no way they can throw this out. And in order to throw one case out, they'd have to throw 100 cases, because by the time the month is up, or next month or two, we're going to have 100 cases in this court.
Hey, John.
And it's all one. Subversion against we the people. Subversion against the Constitution. Subversion against the United States of America by enemies both domestic and foreign. And these judges, I don't even know if they're domestic or foreign. They all seem like foreigners to me. But anyway, they are domestic enemies. They're elected individuals or appointed individuals in our court system running courts of jurisdictions unknown. I have no clue what jurisdiction they're running, because they don't tell. And when you try to fit this jurisdiction into it, all of a sudden you get something from that jurisdiction. You try to, and then it gets to the point, they just make it up altogether. It gets to that point, they just make it up. Their own jurisdiction. Yeah, Gerard.
Their charter says that you cannot order or tell the judge anything, which I don't know how you would put a motion in if you can't tell the judge anything. But that's what their charter says, just so you know.
Well, who cares? Because that has nothing to do with us. We don't care.
Well, that's where he's coming from. He thinks you can't tell him anything. That's why he hasn't.
Yeah, and that's why they don't like pro se people in the courtroom. And that's why they're not going to like anything like us in the courtroom. You know? All right, well, anyway, I went on long enough. That's American jurisprudence. Maybe when Brent gets on, if he wants to talk a little bit about American jurisprudence, he can too. And I don't know, do you have anything else to add to this, Gerard?
No, I already put my 2 cents in between you, thanks.
Okay, before we move over to Brent, let's take on Robert. I think, is Robert the only speaker for tonight with any updates, Jen?
Right.
Yeah,
he's
there.
The one.
Okay, go ahead, Robert, and I'll make my comment after you. And I'm sure Brent's going to make a comment, too.
We had a fun day today. It actually started last Thursday. See, last Thursday, the jury had questions concerning what constitutes conspiracy. And so before lunch, they met with the judge. And at that time, they made a decision, because the jury is running their own schedule. They made the decision that they were going to leave on Thursday at 1 p.m. and be gone Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and come back to work today. Well, they just probably was at the courthouse this morning, maybe an hour, when they announced that they had a partial verdict. That would seem to say that maybe they got together over the weekend to hash it out. Now, what they had is they had two people that they had guilty charges on. One of them was the Burleson, the FBI informant. They found him guilty on 8 out of 10 charges.
Explain how he became a defendant, because I don't think people know.
Well, he tried to use his position as an informant to do some other things that was illegal, with the thought, I guess, of getting away with it, being an informant. And the FBI kind of, at the last, you know, when the word came out, they cut him loose. And so he's gone through the trial, and he was found guilty on 8 charges. Now, the other guy, Todd Engel, they found him guilty of two charges. But the charges, I can't remember exactly what they were at the moment, but they're minor enough. He probably gets off with a time served. Sentence.
Was Todd Engel an informant also?
No.
Okay.
He wasn't. But it okay. seemed like they seemed like the jury did not have any. They didn't like Fed informants evidently because they hit him hard. Now, what's interesting is nobody's found guilty on conspiracy charges, so that knocks out a bunch of charges right there that was tied in with the conspiracy. But there were seven defendants in this trial. Two were charged with things. The other five is a hung jury. So the judge invokes the Allen rule and sends the jury back in to deliberate some more from a different perspective. And they weren't in there very long, and they came back out and said, "Nah, we're still hung. We can't go any further." So the judge declared it a mistrial, and they reset trial again for June 26th, which is the day that the second trial for the next group was supposed to happen. So everybody's been pushed back so that they can retry these same people again. However, these the two people that were found guilty, that stands.
Well, a hung jury is an acquitted jury, one that acquits, because you can't, if they can't come to a conclusion, then their conclusion is they don't have a conclusion. I think the only thing this judge could have done, or as far as I'm concerned, is to send them back and again. And tell them you're not leaving until you come to a conclusion, and even if that means that they have to get inside and say, okay, we're all just going to come to the conclusion, since we can't come to a conclusion, we're going to have to acquit, and they should have came out that way.
Well, she declared it a mistrial.
There's no such thing as a mistrial. Maybe Brent will comment on this too. I think he agrees with this position, that there's no such thing as a mistrial. You can't have a mistrial because they disagree, because they can't come to a conclusion. That's not a mistrial. That really is an acquittal. You have to have all of the jurists have to agree guilty, or the defendants walk. It's that simple. There's nothing else to talk about, right. And judges have no authority and power over that. They can't make a decision here to begin with, because they can't second guess the jury.
Right. Well, they,
and by sending it back into another jury is second guessing the jury.
They could not find anybody else of those other five. They couldn't find any of them guilty on anything, and they couldn't find them not guilty either. So it was a hung jury. And
well,
so,
if you can't find them guilty on something, then they're not guilty. I mean, there must have been something. There must have been some people saying, no, they're guilty, and the rest of them say not guilty or something, no?
Well, I guess probably some of them thought them guilty on things, and the others said, no, I don't think so. And so they couldn't come to a unanimous decision on any of it for the other five. Which were the main
Do we know how
people.
Many people hung up the jury?
I'm sorry?
They don't tell you that.
I don't know how many people.
I can't decipher two people talking.
Yeah, do we know how many people hung the jury? Is there any knowledge of that?
No, we don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think we would, but who knows these days that they didn't come out and say, well, we've got two people who won't talk, you know, who won't go along.
Yeah, we were hoping that if it was going to be a hung jury that it was at least 50-50, but we don't know.
All right. Okay, I have nothing else. Do you have anything else, Gerard? We'll pass it over to Brent.
No, except for I have heard of judges taking the majority rule in juries. I mean, that's so far out of whack, but that they've done it. So I don't, you know what I mean? Just beware.
Well, I have just a couple more comments that, you know, there was an increased population of police officers immediately after the it was announced that the jury had a partial verdict. They brought in tons of more police officers. Evidently, the judge probably thought she was going to get a guilty verdict. And there were two helos flying over, and you could see the snipers hanging out the doors. Kind of overkill, well, don't you think?
Maybe that was for a not guilty verdict.
I don't know, but that was said by somebody, but I tend to think they were expecting the guilty verdict and an uprising out of the supporters out there or something.
If they come out of that court not guilty, we're going to shoot them right on the steps.
Yeah, that crossed my mind.
Okay, let's move on. Gerard, I'm going to pass the controls to you. I've been having problems with my controls anyway. I'm going to move to another computer in a few minutes, but I'm going to pass everything over to you. We're in Q&A right now, so there's no reason to turn it on.
Right.
Anybody can get in Q&A, *6 to get into Q&A. And we're going to move over to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. And if you haven't read that book, it's really a book that you need to read if you want to really learn about the common law. Brent Winters also has a website, commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks, John. And we say, as we try to remember to say, the opinions that are expressed here are not may not be necessarily the opinions of NLA, but often I find they are. And we all can learn whether we agree or disagree. It'll make us think about it, whatever is important, a little more. I listen, of course, as I can to the discussion preceding what I've said. One of the things that came up was that this is worthy of mentioning. It was the subject of sheriffs being liable for the escape of federal. And I don't know everything about that particular subject, but I'll tell you what I do know, and maybe it'll connect some thoughts. It does for me knowing this. Where I come from, there's a small county there. It doesn't have but about 10,000 people in it. And they built, before this, they had a nice little courthouse, a nice courthouse square. And jail was in the courthouse because that's all they needed. Then all of a sudden they wanted to raise a little money and build a brand new courthouse separate in this little tiny county, and they did, separate. It's on the courthouse square, and it's not pretty. It's not pretty to have a prison or a jailhouse, a big ugly one especially, ugly one. They're all ugly, by the way. The bigger they get, the uglier they look. It does something to a whole town. Well, they built a big one. That was a lot of prisons. And here's what happened, and a small place, and I kind of knew the sheriff. It was the county neighboring my old home county. And what they were doing there was housing federal prisoners. And in that little county of just about 10,000 people, they were making over $1 million a year housing federal prisoners, and they wanted to make $2 million a year. And the feds want to do that. And the reason they want to do it is because, now watch me here, they want to do that because the feds want to do it because that is the way they control the whole country. You control the sheriffs locally. You control Burton or everything. And they do. They control the sheriffs in every county in America. And all this noise about the power of the sheriff and what the sheriff can do has been completely castrated. And the folk aren't talking about it. I listened to Sheriff Mack a year or two ago. He was on the radio. And, of course, I'm for his point of view, what he's saying. But I called into the show, and I asked him about that situation. And he was sheriff, as some of you might recall, in a small, very small rural county in New Mexico. And I made point of it. I said, the sheriffs will never be able to do what you're doing. I said, that's my stated opinion, anyway, as long as they're kept and paid for by the federal government. And they are. And in a big way, by the way. Funds, as a matter of fact, one county at home, sheriff was there for 12 years, and he told me, he said, Brent, if it wasn't for this federal money, we'd go broke. We're dependent on it entirely now, all that we do. And he said, I campaigned on it when I ran the last time that I'm making money for this county. Oh, he just talked about how wonderful it all was. And he was getting over $4 million a year housing federal prisoners. Well, anyway, I asked Sheriff Mack, and he said, when last year I was sheriff, we got $900,000 about in federal funds housing federal prisoners. But he said, and I told my men this, he said, we're not getting this for nothing. We're not getting a handout from the federal government. We're doing something. Well, you may be doing something, but I know how it works. You know, when you go to federal prison, anybody goes to federal prison, the first thing all prisoners are going to ask him is, did you come from county or did you come off the street? That's the phrase. Did you come from county or did you come off the street? Because if you came off the street, you had it easy. But if you came from county, and the bigger the town, the more this is true, but it's also true at the local level. You get up in the morning in county jail if you're a federally housed prisoner under contract, you see. If you're under contract, then if you escape, the judge is liable to the federal government. That's the way that works. That makes sense. Well, if you're there and you're being housed, awaiting trial or on probation, whatever. If you're doing that, you get up in the morning and you get a stale donut for breakfast, maybe. And then at noontime, you may get a ham sandwich with some cheap fake cheese food on it, 2 pieces of white bread. And then for supper, you might get a TV dinner. And I don't know the exact figures, but if the county gets $50 or $100 per prisoner per day, and that's all they spend to feed him, well, they make a lot of money. That's what it's all about. How cheap can we feed these men? You see, did you come from county or did you come from off the street? Well, if you came from county, we know you were starved to death probably and treated a whole lot worse. Well, that's fact. It's bad enough in federal prison, but county jail because of the money that's being made. And it look worse than that is the control then that the feds have over local county sheriffs. All they have to do is say to them, look, you either support our policies, assist us in supporting our gun control laws, et cetera, but we're pulling our money. We're not going to send you any more federal prisoners. And then what are you going to do? You see how subtle and nefarious it all is and how the system has grown? Now, how do we stop that at this point? The only way you can do it is cold turkey. How are you going to get 3,000 sheriffs in the United States. How are you going to get them to quit? Once people get addicted to money, they're in government. See, most people don't have a clue where that money's coming from, and if all of a sudden it disappears, they're going to vote that next sheriff out of office. He doesn't take any federal prisoners because he doesn't have any money. He can't even run the programs that they have, all the fancy educational baloney programs that they do in the jails and all that stuff. At any rate, that's what I know about it. If that connects any dots about why sheriffs are liable, maybe somebody can do further research and find out more about it. And a while ago, the jurisprudence was mentioned, and John read a definition that was so long, I think it needed to have somebody put a tail on it. That definition for jurisprudence was a whole lot, in my humble opinion, a whole lot of hooey. Just a whole lot of talk didn't amount to a pinch of dried owl manure. Now, why do I say that? Well, there were some good things said in it, but by the time you get done, you'd really have to study it for a month or two and then think it through for it to be usable. And ultimately, jurisprudence is just nothing but a big, fancy, ugly Latin word that is cumbersome, that somehow has crept into our thinking. What does jurisprudence mean? Well, all it means fundamentally, if you just go back to the etymology, it just means the prudent thing to do. What's prudent? What is prudent? What is foreseen? And again, I want to stress that that definition has some good stuff in it, but it's just too much. I mean, if you can't define something, and I think you were reading, John, you may tell us later, if you were reading from American Jurisprudence or something, but if law is not quickly graspable by the man out on the courthouse square that's doing business out there, or sitting on the bench out in front of the courthouse, or one of those kind of fellows, if he can't grasp it within 30 seconds, it's no law at all. It's just a lot of talk. And unfortunately, that's what lawyers that write especially often do, and it's hard to guard against it. I recognize that, because you say, well, I want to get it all in there. I want to get in there everything that I think it is. And so they write these long, laborious sentences, like Justice Story said, he who draws a labored length of reasoning out puts straws in lines for winds to whirl about, and he who tells a tedious tale of learning o'er counts but sands on ocean's boundless shore. And the brevity of our expression of law is its strength. God help us that we learn to say things quickly, shortly, tertly, briefly, so that not only other people can understand, but we can understand too. And by the way, I've read books on jurisprudence. I mean, devoted to this thing, whatever it is they call jurisprudence. I've read the experts, the ones that people hold up in esteem, and they all disagree with each other. And they all fight and debate, and they can't come to any conclusion. What is jurisprudence? And bottom line, jurisprudence is just doing what the true lawgiver says to do. That's it. And if that's done, then nothing else matters. Obey. You see disputes? That means there has to be, if there's not an objective standard whereby men can resolve their differences, then there's going to be a fight. And it can get real ugly. And we want to define it simply and quickly. Well, that's my idea on jurisprudence, by the way. It really doesn't amount to much, except we just need to do what the true law commands that we do so that we can live and not die. And I'm not exaggerating. When I say this, I'm a fellow that's been around the barn and really thought that at one time in my life there was something to all those big words and I had to understand them. And I did it all. I went through the process of trying to do that and read the books over a period of years. As a matter of fact, I read one fellow who was an expert on jurisprudence, and he was reading another fellow with whom he disagreed on jurisprudence. And I'd read both books, by the way. I'd read both of those big, cumbersome books. Well, he said he took the other fellow's book with whom he disagreed, and he got on his hammock out in the backyard, got him a big, long stogie cigar, a fat one too, probably, and got him a glass of iced tea and relaxed on a summer day. He said, I'm going to read this book. And he said he read the other fellow's book, and he wrote him a letter, and I read the letter that's published in his book. And he said, I say this in all honesty, I did not have a clue what you were talking about from start to finish. Well, then all of a sudden I said, whoa, I read both books, and I didn't have a clue what they were talking about, either one of them. And so it made me, I thought I was stupid. That's why I didn't understand. No, then I found out the experts don't understand each other. So I quit it. I said, that's enough of all that malarkey, to use a technical term of art. Jurisprudence. It's a fancy Latin word, and if we get rid of all that Latin talk the Roman church gave us all those years, we'd all understand things a lot better. Then we mentioned conspiracy. Yeah, I do want to mention conspiracy. Conspiracy, said Justice Jackson of the U.S. Supreme Court, the last justice to sit on the Supreme Court that never went to law school. Justice Jackson, chief prosecutor of Nuremberg, by the way. He said, conspiracy is the darling of the prosecutor's nursery. Conspiracy is the darling of the prosecutor's nursery. Why is it? Why? Well, by the way, He also was a lifelong prosecutor, government employee, and turned out to be a left-wing wacko. So just because he didn't go to law school, that didn't save him from being the guy that saved all of Roosevelt's communism and all of his New Deal programs. He saved them. He was a stitch in time that saved mine on the Supreme Court. He flipped and said, I'm going to support it all, and did, and followed Roosevelt like a slobbering lackey. Doesn't mean he didn't say some smart things. He did. Men at their best, I keep saying it over and over again, men at their best are still only men at best. And that's not saying much. So we take what good we can out of them and keep moving and try to do better ourselves. That's the only thing that will hold things together. Well, conspiracy. The reason prosecutors like conspiracy so much is because it's so easy to prove, and it's so easy also to accuse people of. Oh, you can... And the reason it's easy to accuse them is because it's so simple. Simple to prove. Here, elements, as a matter of law, of conspiracy are only two. Here they are. Number one, you have to prove an agreement between two or more persons. Number two, you have to prove that that agreement was to commit a crime. Conspiracy is, by definition, an agreement to commit a crime. And we can go to the Bible, for example, and go to the book of Acts, and we find there a band of Jews. They took a blood oath together, a blood oath, that they would not eat or drink until they had murdered Paul the Apostle. You can read it there in the book of Acts. Get your concordance out, look up the word blood oath. That particular agreement, supported by oath, by the way, is a conspiracy. A conspiracy is an agreement to commit a crime. Of course, they thought they were serving God, but it doesn't make any difference. You can be sincerely wrong and still, well, you're supposed to know you're not supposed to murder people. That's what you're supposed to know. Well, they apparently, I don't know whether they knew it or not, but they did it. That's conspiracy. But it gets worse. It gets easier because I've seen cases where people on one side of the United States who had never met somebody on the other side of the United States were both convicted of the same conspiracy. Why? Because the one fellow on the East Coast knew, they proved, that he knew if he did this, this, and this, and that the other fellow on the West Coast did this, this, and this, that they'd both make money. And they never spoke. They didn't have any written agreement. It just kind of arose that they started acting in concert this way. And it was a drug case, and pretty soon they were both making money, so the court said that constitutes an agreement, and of course then the jury said, yeah, that's what was going on, agreement to commit a crime, therefore they're guilty of conspiracy. But it gets even worse than that. The conspiracy theories are like the spokes of a wheel, the lawyers say, and it's true. If I have an agreement with you, and I'm on the East Coast, and you're on the West Coast, and I have this unspoken agreement, and then the fellow on the West Coast has an unspoken agreement with a man in South America, and then the man in South America has another unspoken agreement with a man back in the United States, and then, of course, he has an unspoken agreement with a whole bunch, a lot of fellows in Chicago, Illinois, that are out on the street selling crack cocaine or guns or whatever they're selling. They say they're not supposed to be selling. All those people are guilty of the same conspiracy. It's proven before the jury. So conspiracy is dangerous. Conspiracy is used to send lawyers to prison. Here's how it works. You advise your client in a tax case, for example. They're saying, no, the guy tried to invade taxes. You advise him to get summoned before the grand jury, and you advise him to not talk before the grand jury. Take the fifth, every question. What's your name? I take the fifth. Where do you live? Objection. Fifth. I take the fifth. And on it goes. Doesn't talk. Well, they come back and say, well, the statute says that it's a crime to hinder, delay, or impede. I'm thinking of the verbs of the statute. The federal statute says it's a crime to hinder, delay, or impede the payment of a lawful tax. Okay, the lawyer tells him to not say anything. He takes the fifth, which is the job of a lawyer, tell people that if he thinks it's, not make them do it, but advise them to do it. That's what a lawyer is supposed to do. He does that. Well, then the feds come back and say, well, you did what you did, and he did what he did, and now that's impeding us, and we can't collect the tax. Yeah. And so then they indict the lawyer. Now, how do you defend people? And, of course, we had talked last week and the week before about Mr. Mumford. They tased him in court. How do you defend people if you're a lawyer and they try to kill you in court while you're arguing before the court or the jury, or you're asking for a warrant? I've done all those things, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, it's a wonder I didn't get tased. Maybe things are ratcheting up. But remember, when government uses force, that's the only tool they have. The only tool government has is force and threat of force to get people to do what they want. There is no other tool. Well, deceit, I suppose. But when it comes right down to it, they'll try to deceive you, but if that doesn't work, force or threat of force. And if that doesn't work, they only have one option. More force. If that doesn't work, what's the next option? More force. That's why we get things like over 30 murdered children at Waco by a lesbian crazy woman who's now dead. Well, that's conspiracy. There was another, yes, there was one other thing I wanted to mention. I'm glad you, all you guys, all you fellows, people have asked questions. I'm glad you bring all these things up. You're asking questions that are near and dear to my heart, the answers to the questions, and raising questions about it. So the jury was hung down in Las Vegas, apparently. And John made the point that, well, that means the case should be over. But no, they say it's a mistrial. Well, I agree. It's with John. It's not a mistrial. Listen, if they don't get a unanimous, all 12 agree that one way, or that they don't get all 12 agree that the man's guilty, well, then that means the government didn't prove their case. That seems simple enough to me. And if the government didn't prove their case, our common law says they're innocent. They remain innocent. They've always been innocent. They'll prove them guilty. The government didn't prove them guilty. Why, then, are they put in jeopardy of life, liberty, or property a second time when double jeopardy, which means you can't be tried twice for the same crime, why do they get a second bite at it? Now, the courts have said, when does double jeopardy attach? In other words, at what point do you know you've been tried twice? Let's say you go to court and they pick the jury. They pick 11 jurors out of 12. And then for some reason the government drops the case. They find something out and drop the case. Was that person tried? And our courts have said no. Jeopardy doesn't attach until the jury is, all 12 jurors are impaneled. The doctrine called double jeopardy. Double jeopardy means you can't be tried twice for the same crime. You can't be put in danger of life and limb and property and liberty. Not twice. But it happens. And this thing about a mistrial. Notice, too, another principle that's important to recognize here. We are not a democracy. Conservative people often say that's true. We're not a democracy. That's mob rule. They say we're a republic. Well, no, we're not really a republic either. We're not a republic. The Greeks, anciently, never made a distinction between republicanism and democracy, but they were synonyms. They meant the same thing. And they still mean the same thing throughout the world. And I think I've said this on these presentations. All the communist countries called themselves republics because that's what they were. We have them yet today, China, the Republic of China, USSR, the Soviet Socialist Republic. Napoleon's France was a hardcore dictatorship, but it was called republicanism. That was their movement. They said, we are French Republicans. And, well, that's not what America is. America is not a democracy. America is not a republic. Now, our Constitution says that we're guaranteed a republican form of government. And that means that we send representatives to a legislature. That's all that means. It's an important thing. It's a part of our common law government. Fortescue in the 15th century called it the democratic element. It's just a democratic element, a majority element. A majority, that's a better way to say it, a majority element of common law government. But the majority does not rule in a common law country. We are a common law country. that's what makes us different than all the rest of the world, is not because we're a republic. The communist countries are republics. I say it again. Our Constitution talks about republican form, not the substance of the government, not the way it works. We in America, and most fundamental to all government in America, is a jury, because that's where the final decision is made in individual instances. And it has nothing to do with any majority. It's all or nothing. 12 men or nothing. And even the grand jury, we've said this before, we need to repeat it again. Even the grand jury has to be 12. And if there aren't 12 that agree, there is no indictment. And that doesn't make any difference whether the grand jury is 12 members, 16 members, 15 members, 18 members, 23 members, 36 members. There still has to be 12. It's not a majority vote in the grand jury. That's seldom mentioned. It should be mentioned. Where do we get such an idea? From whence did this come, this idea of 12? And I've tried to trace it back. I can trace it back in the history, reading what men have discovered and wrote. I can trace it back to England. I can trace it on back to Europe, to the north of Europe. I can trace it back to that place called Jutland and the vicinity of Jutland, where the Danes and the Angles and the Saxons were, those three tribes. But I can trace it also to the other Germanic tribes in what we call today Saxony, and I can trace it to Sweden and Norway, and it's all there. And then you can go back a little further and trace it down through the German tribes a little bit. But then it gets lost in the fog of antiquity. We lose the trace. But if we go on, there's a big hiatus there, but if we jump back and we go back to the ancient times of the writing of the Bible, we discover it in the Bible in those times, the principle of 12. And the number 12 is exceedingly important. It's no accident. I just bought 6 dozen eggs the day before yesterday. Dozens. We got dozens. Why do we have dozens? Why is 12 important with eggs? In England, in the north of England, still they have what they call the long hundred. The long hundred. That's 120. It's the dozen times 10. And it's still used as a matter of commodity. Certain commodities are sold. They're sold for long hundred. And we have this thing called a dozen. We use it a lot. We use it in even in our nautical language. We have the fathom and the 6 foot was half a 12 foot. 12 inches to a foot. 12 is very important. It always has to do with, we see in the Bible and we see in nature, it has to do with governance. And what is the most fundamental decision of governance among us as a people together? It is the governance in individual instances. That's what decides the cases, and that's where the ultimate power, whoever controls the decision in disputes in individual instances, controls everything. And only in America, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the countries that are protected by them, only in those countries is that power given to 12 people off the street, just grabbed people, men standing around. It's given to them ultimate judgment. That is significant beyond anything else about us as Americans. And it is a, as some people say now, it's a God thing. God said that's the way it's going to be. Why did he say that? Well, he's got his reasons in himself, but we have discovered that there's not any principle among men that delivers what we call justice any more efficiently than impaneling 12 men to decide the facts of the case. And by the way, another thing about the jury, once the facts are decided, that's the power. The facts are the power. I was reading today, reading in the morning, the history about England had to do with the Reformation there. And this fellow wrote the book. He wrote the book in 1853. But he said this. He said the priests did all they could to replace notorious facts with scholasticism. Now, that word, or that phrase, notorious facts is a common law phrase in the sense that the word notorious means so blatantly obvious that no proof is needed. In the courts, we call that judicial notice. In our Declaration of 76, it says we hold these truths to be self-evident. That means requiring no proof. So blatantly obvious. That's what a notorious fact is. It's open, blatant for display. And he made the observation that what the scholastics wanted to do was replace, and I'll use another word to define scholasticism, to replace facts with logic. Replace facts with logic. Replace facts with reason. And not just any fact, notorious fact. And that's where we have to start. And that's why our Declaration of 76 says, if it starts, this is where everything starts, it says we hold these truths to be self-evident. We don't have to prove this. And then he founds everything upon those facts that are so notorious you don't have to prove them. But the law of the city turns that around. Blackstone makes this point in his commentaries in the first volume. He says the law of the city system is upside down. They stress logic. What does common law stress? Facts. And whoever controls the facts controls everything. And who controls the facts in America in cases of individual dispute? The jury. 12 guys that are grabbed that just happen to be standing around. They control the facts, not the government. And if we ever get to the point that the government's controlling the facts, and that's why there's such a battle, of course, in the media, to control the facts. They talk today about the narrative. Well, what they mean is the facts, the story, what really happened. And whoever can create that perception will win. Well, speaking of facts and speaking of self-evident truths, by the way, Paul the Apostle, the Bible is built on the same principle. Everything in it. Facts come first. I ask people often just for fun, who wrote more of the New Testament than any other writer of the New Testament? And people generally will say Paul the Apostle, because he wrote out of 27 books, depends on whether you think he wrote Hebrews, he wrote about 13. But he didn't write more of the New Testament than anybody else. The man who wrote more pages of the New Testament than any other man wasn't a Jew. He was a non-Jew by the name of Luke. Luke wrote two books, the Gospel called Luke and the Book of Acts. And both of those books that take up more than any other writer, neither one of those books has a pinch of theology in it. Those books are pure fact from start to finish. And he says at the beginning that he's going to, at the beginning of the Gospel, for centuries, they always appear together. And that is the foundation, that matter of fact, the testimonies of the evangelist, the gospel records, and the book of Acts are at the front of the Newer Testament. Those are the facts of what happened. And that forms the basis for everything else. Paul the Apostle said, I delivered unto you that which I first received. And then he recounts the facts in brief of who Jesus Christ is, what happened to him, the burial, death, burial, resurrection, right on down the line. And then in the end, that's just the fact of the matter. Take it or leave it. What are you going to do with it? It's the fact. Men don't have to be taught to think. I was in a long discussion with my 91-year-old father just yesterday on this point. He made some good points, though. I made some, too, and I know that thinking's important, and that's what he was trying to say. He said, people aren't thinking. I said, yeah, no, Dad, they aren't thinking. That's it. But the truth is, beyond that, they're not even getting the facts, and when they see the facts, they don't want them. They reject them. Well, he agreed with me on that point. Men don't have to be taught to think. Horses are born to run. Birds are born to fly. Beasts of prey are born to ferocity. Hounds are born to hunt. Man, he's born to think. That's what really sets him apart. And he will. Thinking is not something that's learned. It's a habit that's developed. It's a discipline. To not be mentally lazy and think, that's true. But it's still something, what comes naturally to us. And once we have the facts, and once our neck is in the noose, once our life, liberty, or property, or money, or whatever is on the line, we'll think it through, and we'll come to the rational conclusion, and we will either accept it or reject it to our life or to our death. Well, back to the Declaration of 76. I'm trying to move through it, but this lively discussion that you folks set up, I'm thankful for it and wanted to make comments. You invited me to, and I'm glad you did. Well, natural law. Let's talk about that a little before I quit. What is natural law? Well, I mentioned it a while ago. Natural law is not scholasticism. Natural law is not reason. Natural law is not logic. Well, then what is it? It's the way things are. That's what it is. It's the way things are, and they're not going to change. Dad and I discussed. Dad's a farmer. He'd been a farmer all his life. I said, Dad, you can't plant in the fall just because you think it'd be more convenient to your schedule. Well, you can. You can dig the ground up and plant in the fall. But you know and I know that you'd starve to death if you did that. He said, yes, that's true. God has set the times and the seasons, and that ends the matter. That's the fact of the matter. That's law, and it will not change. The Pharisees came to Jesus Christ, and they said something about marriage, talking about, of course, they wanted to divorce their wives because they burnt the biscuits. I'm not exaggerating. That was the law of the Talmud. You get divorced for anything. Get rid of the gal. You're tired of her? Get rid of her. Get another one. And they did. That was part of their culture. Paul the Apostle was part of that culture. And he said, well, then why is it we're allowed that Moses said we could write a bill of divorcement when we divorce our wives? And Jesus Christ said, Moses said that and wrote that because of the hardness of your hearts. But from creation, it was not so. From creation. And his point there is, God at creation has set the way things are, and they're not going to change. And the only reason Moses wrote that about the bill of divorcement, because he said, when you sin, and when you do that, I command you to not leave your poor wife in the lurch so she doesn't have proof that she's no longer married and she can't remarry. I read a case this morning. Where, what case, what state was that? I believe it was in New Mexico, where the court ordered a man to write, it was in 1989, I believe, ordered a man to write a bill of divorcement and cited that passage out of Deuteronomy. Now, he thought it was a good idea that you assist his wife, so they needed the facts. That's what it was, assist her in getting this bill of divorcement so she has proof that she's no longer married to you, and she wants it according to the way her religious sensibilities want it, right out of the Bible. This is fundamental law. It's not just to take or leave. This is what God said. But the point I'm driving at is that natural law is not logic. It is not rationality. It is fact. It's a fact. It's the way things are. And I like to say the laws of nature are the way things are and the nature of things. That's what our common law is. It is an observation. The laws of nature are what we observe. Standards of conduct inherent in any given relationship among men and women. And these are discoverable through what I call a common consensus. Consensus. That means your senses. You can see it. You can hear it. And con means with other people. You all see it. It's self-evident, like we were saying a while ago. There's some things that just are. The sun is shining. It is raining outside. You plant in the spring and you harvest in the fall. That's just the way it is. I don't know why God made it that way. It sure is convenient in some ways. Jesus Christ said that it's to be one man and one woman. No polygamy. Solomon, David, and all the other patriarchs, the Bible, that had several wives, notwithstanding, God never said that was right. They got away with it for a time. And Jesus Christ then affirmed that it wasn't right, even though these men did these things. Keep in mind that everything the Bible says was said and done was said and done. It's a record of fact. But also keep in mind that everything the Bible says was said and done wasn't right. The Bible records a lot of wrong things, and it does it for a purpose, obviously. It records history. And it tells the naked, ugly truth, the facts of the matter in every case without error, at least in the original autographs. We'll say that much. Well, these things are discoverable, the facts of the matter, the laws of nature, the knowledge of God's character. He is the lawgiver. And his law, as it expresses itself through his creation, you can see it. Through his creation, through the Bible, guided by our senses. That's natural law, then, is the inborn knack to sense right from wrong, and this knack sleeps in every person until threat of harm, righteous outrage, or passion for kindness arouses. It is the ability to discern law's standard once one realized the need. And he who never quotes is never quoted. So I'm going to quote again John Locke, the man upon whom Tom Jefferson relied more than any other in writing the Declaration of 76. He relied on his writings. He wasn't there. Jefferson, by the way, said John Locke was one of the three greatest mortals who ever lived. John Locke said this: God has furnished men with faculties sufficient to direct them in the way they should take if they will but seriously employ them. Let me do that again. God has furnished men, said John Locke, with faculties sufficient to direct them in the way they should take if they will but seriously employ them. Note well, John Locke does not say that men know naturally right from wrong. The fact is, they don't. What he does say is, men have the faculties to discover those things if they will but do it. And I add this, God makes us all responsible to find out what is right and what is wrong. We do not know until we learn. And dropping the Holy Spirit on a man and in a man, and God does that, does not make him instantaneously knowledgeable of the law and what is right and what is wrong. No. That's why the book of Hebrews says that you must exercise your senses to learn, to discipline yourself, to understand the right application of the never-changing principle in individual instances. We must learn. I learned the laws of nature when I was a little boy. I reached up on the stove and I grabbed the iron skillet handle sticking out. I never did that again. It burnt my hand. I learned the laws of nature, the natural law, the laws of thermodynamics. God created them. Iron conducts heat. You can hurt yourself. And I learned a lot of lessons since then. I did a lot of, well, maybe that was the way I learned. I'm just fortunate I didn't get hurt. I'm sure many of those that are listening to me would say, you wonder, too, how you stayed alive all those years. Well, I can say that, too. I wonder how I stayed alive and some of the dumb things I did and the chances I took. And sometimes I didn't even know I was taking a chance. It makes me shake to think about it at times. Well, I was learning the laws of nature. But going further, common law and government is the outworking of this natural law among a people. Common law and government is the outworking of this natural law. Men observing in nature the way things that are. Reading court cases. Court cases will give you the facts. Appellate courts write the facts. They'll tell you what the case is about. And then they'll say, well, here's what we have found, and here's our finding. Here's what we've concluded. And you may agree with them. You may not. But that's what our common law is. Men, juries, saying, here's what we, given the evidence, here's what we say happened. And here's what we think should be the result, the application of the law. Nature is the mountain. Watch this. Nature is the mountain. I'm quoting, but I'm quoting myself on this one. Nature is the mountain from which blocks of facts are hewn. Facts are the foundation stones upon which the frame of reason sets. And reason is the tool revealing how law applies to government. So there is nature, there is creation, there is nature, the nature of things, the way things are. And facts are hewn, the stones taken out of nature. These are the facts. And then the facts become the building material, the reason. I was in a court case once and trying to think of an argument. What can I say? What can I say to the jury that would persuade them? I thought a lot of things. I had another fella help me, and he came up with a lot of good ideas, a young fella. He wasn't a lawyer, by the way. He was only about 20 years old. he did an excellent job. He said, here's what I think you ought to say. He used a lot of that. It's been 15 years ago. But I ended up saying the government says that, and this, it was a conspiracy to commit murder case in a federal court, crossing state lines with the intent to conspire to commit murder at one moment she crossed the state line. That's what the government said at. Never, no murder was ever committed, of course, but the government said to the jury, we have an overwhelming mountain of facts. And boy, did they present facts, every little thing they could think of. But to me, the way I saw their facts, it was a mountain. It was a huge thing. But to me, it was nothing but a mountain of piled bricks. It was not a mountain of bricks built by a mason, not a mountain, but a wall or a building, an edifice, laid out like a mason would lay out the bricks. They didn't do that. They just piled, like somebody take a dump truck, full load of old bricks, and just dumped it in a big pile. Disconnected. None of the dots were connected. That's what scholasticism is. The facts really don't matter in scholasticism. What matters is I really understand logic, and I'm really smart. I can tell you all the rules of logic, and I can tell you what a bad argument is, an ad hominem argument, and all that baloney. I hear these, again, more Latin words thrown around that most people hearing it don't have a clue what you're talking about. In short, natural law depends upon facts in nature. Nature depends upon nature's God. Natural law is so-called because its discovery depends upon nature in two respects. One discovers nature's facts by digging and looking, then by using one's natural ability to reason based upon the facts dug from nature's mouth. And then by that, one comes to conclusions. Now, I'm going to quit, I think, for two reasons. I think I've been talking long enough. Besides that, my voice gets tired. But next time, Lord willing, I want to go to the passage of the Bible from which, through the centuries, men have said, we understand what natural law is, and it has been misconstrued and misunderstood. And that's Romans, Paul the Apostle, writing to the Christians at Rome, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Oh, Lord willing, we'll talk about those next time. John, again, thanks, and don't forget, the only remedy to lawlessness, and we're seeing it all around us, the only remedy is true law.
Thank you, Brent.
Thanks, John. Oh, this is Gerard. Thanks, Gerard.
Yeah. Okay, that's okay. Hey, just another piece of news that I just got from Holly. That jury was hung by two jurors. All of them were innocent. Two hung the jury. So it was like a 90% jury. So that's pretty amazing. Okay, so I'm going to open up the queue. Crystal Mack, you're in there. I'm going to unmute you. If you got a question for Brent or anybody else, go ahead. Are you there, Crystal? Hello, Crystal. I don't hear a thing. Let me mute you and then unmute you again. Doesn't look like it worked. How about now, Crystal? Can you hear me?
Hello.
There you go. Now you're there.
Oh.
I don't know.
Yes.
I didn't hear a thing. Like you were muted. So what's up, Crystal?
Yes. I definitely got to talk to you, especially with about the court system, the jurists. I don't think I should even discuss this on this right now. How can I put this? All right. Well, we're getting people involved in the schooling, because I just came from the board meeting and stuff tonight. And people are all excited. As a matter of fact, I saw this minister, and he wants to get all his members involved with this too, because it's the same problem that's going on in the cases that they when people have to go to court and for trials and stuff like that, that common law jury, a lot of cases have never been even settled or what have you, like my case also. And when I asked for the common law jury, it happened from started that Monday. We have a jury and everything up picked out. But some crazy things had happened in my case. And it was, I guess my case was basically thrown out, but some good things came out of it. I definitely got to go over with you. And you also mentioned, I think John mentioned, about the, when we have to make a complaint, because who do you complain to when it comes to the jury? It's the bar. It's the grievance committee.
Yeah, good luck with that. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, because they're all in the same, they're all in the sewer together. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But I wanted to.
Yeah, we'll talk. I'll have to call you, I guess.
Yes, it's very important because I mean, it's good, but I just needed your expertise on this, please.
Right.
You can call me tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow, yeah, because tonight will be too late, I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah, so because I just. I'm sorry.
You started something that's going viral, an idea whose time has come. Everybody understands that there's a problem, and you gave them a solution, and they're excited because, like Brent says, it's self-evident, and you're speaking the truth, and they're like, this is a breath of fresh air, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now all we got to do is hold their feet to the fire with it.
Well, see, this is I'm going to say this. After the case was over, and I thank you all because it's so inspiring because I've been going to the court for the past 3 years, you know. Am I a public servant? Is this my grand jury? And then I said, you committed a treason. They told me to get them out of there. I asked for his oath and bond. I don't got to give you nothing. and so something else. Okay, I will share this with you. After the trial was over, I contacted, because I filed for the bankruptcy, and I said, this is a fraud because I have proof of it. So everybody, when I filed my bankruptcy, I put everyone's name down that said I owed the money. Then I said, I want proof of claim, no due process. So one of them kept on sending me the papers like they never received it, right? So another thing, too, whenever you do anything like that, I ended up faxing them, so they did receive it. So I put it right back in my document. So when I had to go to federal court, they gave me a trustee. Okay? And so they were so nasty and rude to me. The guy from the first guy wasn't that bad, but the second one that he sent in his place, because the judge, I put him in his place, he was very, very disrespectful. And so when I said I wanted a common law grand jury, and they go, well, it's not your call. I said, oh, but it is my call. So then I called back to the trustee, and I said, hi, I said, I would like a common law grand jury. They go, well, you have nothing to say about it. I said, oh, I do. I have everything to say about it because my trustee is also known as me, and he has to be in my best interest. Well, he called me back 5 minutes later, very polite, and I said, and that idiot that you had talking to me on the phone, you know, so he goes, he'll never have to speak to him this and that again. So after my case was over, you know, I called the attorney back, and I said, I want an appeal. He goes, I'm not doing nothing. You get yourself another attorney. So then I contacted my trustee. And my trustee started screaming, look, I'm not doing nothing. I said, oh, but you can't do that. You have my best interest. You are acting as me. So you have to take this.
Crystal, you're like the little boy that came out and said, but he has no clothes. They don't like your questions. Didn't you ask him, who do you represent? He said, well, you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And
you see, nobody's asking those questions. Nobody's asking him those questions.
And one other thing, too, I forgot to share with you. The injured party. And I said, this is how it all started. I said, because they kept on saying, oh, you're not going to get anything back because you owe this and owe that. I said, well, I want proof of claim. I said, oh, by the way, who is the injured party? They said, what? I said, who is the injured party? And they said, well, you are. I said, well, isn't there a law for the injured party? Like when you apply for Social Security, if you get hurt or whatever, why would you collect off of my injury? And all of a sudden I said, and it's only a third, just like Social Security, disability, it's only a third. So most of the people that have lost their cases due to injury, they took all their money and they were the injured party. And that's, you know, as I said, there's so many things that, you know, thank you. So the my trustee told me he's done with me. He wants nothing more to do with me. He's going to file the paperwork, and everything will be dismissed off that bankruptcy.
Really?
No. Yeah.
You mean dismissed in your favor?
Yeah, because he wants nothing to do with me. He goes, everything, yeah, they discharged your case, so we're closing everything out. I don't want nothing to do with you. Don't call me no more. So.
Well, anyway, I'll call you tomorrow. And
finish
up. I'll call you tomorrow.
Oh, definitely, please. Okay.
You're in the Eastern time zone, right? You're right here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Just double check. Okay. Thank you,
okay.
Crystal. Yep. And we have live Ollie.
Okay, hello. You know, Gerard, it puts me in mind. It seemed like all these important juries, or important trials, wind up with a hung jury. I'm beginning to think the feds plant two or three people in there, and I don't know if they pay them or what, to hang the jury. Now, all these trials have a common thread. There's no bail. The defendants seem to spend a lot of time in solitary. They're subjected to physical abuse and psychological abuse, okay? And that this is the way the feds, that's the way they're do-over. They put in there and then they get a hung jury, okay? Then it's double jeopardy and they're getting away with it. In the meantime, the prisoners spend more time in solitary, more abuse. Now, I remember years ago, somebody told me that it takes 12 jurors for a conviction. And along in that sermon comes the words, beyond the shadow of a doubt. Okay? The good defense attorneys, if they could spread a little bit of doubt in that jury and spread enough doubt, their defendants walked free. But I think it's just part of that... all part of that collusion, that conspiracy against the Patriots and all this and that. That's all I got to say, but I see a threat, a commonality there in all these trials, the important ones.
Sure. And then, you know, that makes it that much easier for those guys to take a plea because they realize they're going to get drug out through this whole process.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And so, and they just want to get the hell out of there. You know? I mean, if you threw them a rope, they'd climb out of there if they could. You know what I mean? It's bad.
Well, you know, it's sad. When I was out there in Power Rump, I'm an elder. Okay, a lot of these younger people, they look in my eyes, they sense a spiritual awareness. They look in my eyes, they want answers. And it's awful hard to go in there. I talked to Clive and I talked to Ryan. Even through them, that they're on a TV monitor, however, you can see that look in their eyes. They're looking for answers. They're looking for hope. They're looking for you to say something to say something to, you know, some answers. And it is so frustrating. You walk out of there and your gut is just wrenched, you know, and it's hard to go through all that on the outside. Just what are they going through on the inside? They're going through hell. They're going through hell.
Yep, it's hell on earth. Anyway, thank you, Ollie.
Yep.
Okay, we have David. You are unmuted. Go ahead.
This is David from Missouri. Hi, Gerard.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, I've got a short word about what Brett commented on, and then a question for him, and if you want to follow up with it, that's fine as well. One of the first things he talked about was the sheriff, and essentially, excuse the expression, how they've basically, in essence, become whores for federal dollars and U.S. Marshal and ICE prisoners, you know, to and how they basically campaign, you know, for jobs and money to the county, and, you know, they team up with the county commission and so forth and so on. Couldn't agree more with what he said, because that's what happened in my own county. And Brent also mentioned a story about having, you know, asked Sheriff Mack a question. About 5 years ago, my current sheriff invited myself and the rest of the Republican Central Committee people that were in my town here, township, to go to St. Charles, Missouri, and listen to Sheriff Mack at one of their conventions. And, you know, I was sold on the bill of goods as well and everything, and thought my sheriff was really on board. Long story short, come to find out recently, he's basically the poster boy for, you know, what Brent was talking about and describing what the average sheriff's become. Of course, the people here in my county, 3-1, shot down the proposal for, you know, more federal prisoners, a new prison, larger storage, blah, 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 blah. But look how great we are. We're trying to give you more money and more jobs. So I'm down to that. And I also, here's where my question comes in. And Brent, if you'll comment on this first, you know how the Committee of Safety is pretty much the silver bullet that we have here in LA, and how the role of the constitutional sheriff, his power and responsibility, typically will play a huge part in that. It isn't absolutely necessary if enough people are woken up. Door number two, in other words, hey, we'll boot you out and elect somebody else, is another option, but probably a little less favorable depending on how many people would be willing to stand up and challenge these sheriffs. All of that taken into account, what would you look at as far as what do you think the prospects are of continuing to rely on a sheriff to work with committees of safety as a viable option, or should people just start changing direction and looking to just start replacing as many sheriffs as, you know, willfully want to continue to be federal dollar whores, or what would you suggest to John and Gerard if you were going to even make a suggestion on how to combat that dilemma you were describing to us? That's my question. I'll listen.
Brent may be muted.
I hope not. I would hate to have to repeat all that.
I didn't say he didn't hear you. I said he may be muted. No.
Okay.
Yeah, I had to unmute myself. I listened to everything you said, but I mute myself in case I call for something. At any rate, it's my humble opinion that as long as they're receiving this money from the federal government, the smallest county in America, the smallest county is $1 million at least a year, that there's no way that they're not going to do the bidding a Leviathan. It's not going to happen. And, of course, we're told point blank, and as a matter of common law, as a matter of observation, our Congress has observed and made it official that our national motto is "In God We Trust." That means we do not trust in men. That means we do not trust ourselves. We don't even trust our own spouse. I tell people this. God's command is that all trust goes to Him. Loyalty, Yes, we're to be loyal to our spouse, loyal to our friends, loyal to men of like kindred spirit. But trust does not go to sheriffs. It doesn't go to presidents. It doesn't go to any man, any place. And to do so, it's a spit in God's face, period. That's what the Bible teaches. No exception to that principle that the Bible sets forth. And that's why our Congress has said that our national motto is "In God We Trust." I was encouraged recently. It just happened a short time ago. I was driving through from one end, one side of the state of Illinois to the other, and I saw a state trooper in front of me, and on the back of his car, painted on the back bumper in large letters, was the phrase, "In God We Trust." That surprised me, knowing what Illinois is otherwise. I don't know how it happened there. It has to be ordered from somebody. It's a state trooper's car. It has to be coming from the state capitol. But that is our motto. Our motto is not El Pluribus Unum. It makes no difference what sheriffs do or don't do. Sheriffs aren't running things. Sheriffs are important. They're key. That's important. But they're not, I say they're not running things. Ultimately, the jury, and I can't stress this enough, the jury is the court of last resort among men in God's economy of government. And the unanimity, the agreement of the 12-man jury in individual instances, we say sometimes, show me your lawgiver, and I will show you your God. And everybody has one. Lawgiver, final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances. Show me your lawgiver. Well, God has bequeathed to men, delegated the duty of governance in this age. And the jury is fundamental to that. So much so that God himself grabbed 12 men that happened to be standing around, and he said, I want you to stay with me for the 3 years I'm here, witness the evidence of my messiahship, and then report your verdict to the world.
Amen.
12. And they did it. And they all died except one doing it because they wouldn't change their story. The stories all agreed. They all agreed on the verdict. A poll was taken. You know, at the end of a trial, the jury say, we say he's guilty. And then the, or we say he's not guilty. And then some lawyer, one of the lawyers jump up and say, judge, I request that the jury be polled. Polled, that means, that's an old word, means head. We want you to ask each head, each person personally, to deliver his decision, just to make sure that somebody isn't bashful and he's not been run over in the jury foreman saying something he didn't agree to. Well, that ends the matter. That's a matter of fact. They set the facts, and they even decide whether men live or die in cases of capital crimes, if that's in the part of the law of the state where they are delivering. So, no, I don't think the sheriff is the bottom line. He's not the savior here. Of course, he never was and never will be. God has given us the process that we are to use to make things come out right. It is a process. It is not do this or don't do that as much as the stress of it is. Here's the process you get into. Here's the course of the common law. If you follow this process, when you get to the end of it, I will ratify the result. He says throughout the Old Testament, do not be intimidated by the faces of men. He's talking to jurors and judges. Jurors are judges, by the way. He says, don't be intimidated because the judgment, if you follow my process, the judgment isn't yours. If you follow the process, it's like a piece of machinery. It'll come out in the end, and that's it. And I'll ratify it. And whatsoever is bound on earth shall be bound in heaven. That's what he means when he says that, the New Testament. What's two or three of you together on this matter? Follow this process to get in the process, a particular process to solve a particular problem. And he says, if you follow this, whatever you decide is bound in the skies where I am in heaven. Well, that's what God wants us to do with the jury right now. And by the way, I think Gerard was discussing with Ollie a while ago, and he made mention, I think they're planting people in the jury. Well, I don't think it. I know it, because I've seen it. The feds are notorious for putting their people in the jury. They get them there all kinds of different ways. And, oh, it only takes one, see, because it's not a majority institution. It just takes one person to throw a jury.
Well, Brent.
Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, it sounds then, as you're answering my question, that you agree a lot with what I've heard Gerard and Robert and other leaders say. Hey, if the sheriff's not going to step up and take his role, and he sees the people are waking up enough to become that common law jury that we're hoping to reestablish, then that would really be the only answer left. I mean, and when I mentioned the role of the sheriff before, I'm just talking about how our committees of safety handbooks and stuff is laid down as ideal. It would be ideal if the sheriff was on our side about this, but I agree with you. Ultimately, that authority doesn't rest in the sheriff being a constitutional law officer. They either will or they won't. But I like your answer, though, that if we don't have to have one step up and take their place either, it still rests in the hand of the people as the jury. The way you explain that really just dovetails well into what NLA leadership, has shown and what they presented in the courts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your answer is, I think, everybody needs to really listen closely to what you just said. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, every person will stand before the lawgiver, but God himself, and he will answer. He will answer for what he has done, regardless what any other person has done, the sheriff, the president, some pissy anti-prosecutor or college professor or priest or preacher. It doesn't make any difference who it is or what they've done to you. You're going to answer for it. And they could threaten to throw you in jail, threaten to kill you, and maybe do so. You're still going to answer for staying and doing what the lawgiver wants you to say and do. And you must be wise to discern what that is and do it. So it doesn't make any difference what the sheriff does. We all of us, like John Knox said, would be speaking of Mary, Queen of Scots. She said, I perceive that my people will do as you say and not as I say. And he said, would be to God, madam, that the people of Scotland would do what, and you and me, all of us, would do what God says. Quit talking that way. And she was worried that they wouldn't obey her and started crying. That's the way the world is. That's the way the effeminate world is, and the leaders of it. They're all doing it now. God has given us orders. He's given us a law. We're a blessed people, and he's given us our common law, and we're playing footsie with the faggots of the world. What's wrong with us? And these people, I forget who said what, but John probably said this. He talked about the what law are they following? Is foreign law? I was thinking he was saying that. They're not following the Constitution. He went on and on about that for a while. But reading back during the times of Justice Mansfield, Mansfield lived in the 1700s, about the time of the American separation from Britain. And there was a fellow in Britain at that time that published a newspaper. It was kind of an underground newspaper, but everybody read it. And he complained. He said, when did we ever hear Justice Mansfield talk about Magna Carta? He'll talk about this kind of law and that kind of law, but nobody ever heard him mention Magna Carta. See, the same things that for example, that John's saying or that other people, patriots, are saying today, they were saying the same thing back in England about Magna Carta that we say today about our Constitution. There's no question that both of these documents, vastly different in the way they say things, vastly different in the direct problems they confronted, but the principles are still the same, and it's our common law government. And the judges and the justices, they get highfalutin and they think that they've got a better way of looking at it. And they are sophisticated and they talk about how they do it in Germany. I'm not limited in my understanding. I'm not limited to the United States. I'm a cosmopolitan man and I understand all the laws from the different nations. Get out of here. I mean, these guys are no smarter. Than the forgotten man has become popular. The forgotten man, the man who sets and thinks. You want a law education? You want to really understand the law? Spend 6 months in federal prison or a year. You'll get an education on who's running. Well, if these judges would spend some time there, volunteer, just go there incognito. They'll get an education on what's really going on behind the scenes. Maybe they're too blind to see it. These fellows know. They've got it wired. They understand, but who's listening to them? Well, surely nobody. And I don't expect people to listen. But they themselves and the ones that are around them, they put the word out. They know. They understand. They know who's running the prison system. They see it. They got the clues together, and they also understand a lot about the law, and they spend a lot of time in the law library for obvious reasons. They want out. That'll motivate a man to study. When the hammer comes down on you, when somebody shoots your a family member, some government employee, or throws one of your family members in jail, throws you in jail, all of a sudden, then it all looks different. And you understand that tyranny is real. You know, with this mantra now, oh, we're a free people. They hate freedom. That's why they're attacking America. Freedom? We live in a police state. There's no question. I remember not too many years ago, not to 20 years ago, I remember the people in Europe saying that they wanted to come to America. They're not saying that now. People in Germany are saying America is a police state. We don't want to go there. Now, of course, Germany is not much better. But I'm saying they know that they, but they're saying that, and I've known people that have worked in Germany have come back and told me that that's what they're saying over there. For whatever reason, I'm just saying America is not perceived the way it once was, but we ourselves are foolish enough to keep saying this mantra. Rome went down the tubes. Rome decayed and fell, and while she was falling, people were saying, oh, the great Roman Republic. They were saying it. Israel was saying, and they said to Jesus Christ, we have never been enslaved to any man, or any country, or any people. What are you, crazy? You were enslaved to the Egyptians. You were enslaved to the Babylonians. They came and took you bodily away to Babylon. You're now, as I speak to you, so deeply enslaved in your own sin that you're blind as bats. You got ants in the attic to boot, and you can't see it. Why is it that people, I forget who said this, I'm quoting someone else smarter than me, but I don't remember his name. Why is it, he said, that people, to proclaim their liberty, rattle their chains? They're in chains, and they rattle their chains to proclaim their, it's political correct speech, to proclaim their liberty. Now, people say to me, oh, I've had friends say this to me, well, things are a lot better here than they are everywhere else, right? Now, don't be complaining. No, things are better here. That's true also. And the reason things are better here is because we're complaining, and we've been complaining about the wrong things for quite a few decades. That's what America is. That's freedom of speech, saying that's wrong. You go to Sweden. Wait a minute. I think I lost my mic. You go to Sweden today, and of course, the Islamic people are murdering people like it's going out of style. Raping, gang raping girls. And if you say anything against Islam, you will go to jail. And I've heard Swedish people say, we don't have a First Amendment like you. Well, it's not our First Amendment that gives us freedom of speech. God gave it to us. The First Amendment just says government's supposed to protect it. And they're not doing that as much as they used to, but we do have that. We're speaking. And if you can't do something for fear of getting killed or hurt or thrown in jail, speak. God commands it. That doesn't mean to go off half-cocked when you don't know what you're talking about. It means that you understand the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. What does that mean? That means you understand the Bible. That's what that means. The true lawgiver has given us expressly his law, his standards. He's expressed it in more ways than we can imagine. He gave it to us in statutes and commandments. He gave it to us in pronouncements of due process. He has given it to us in poetry, 5 books of poetry. He's given it to us in books of history. He's given it to us in books of biography, the Gospels. He's given it to us in the epistles. He's given it to us in apocalyptic literature. I said a while ago, facts are the foundation of everything. That's true. The book of Romans. To show you, though, that it is important. Logic's important. The book of Romans is a book of pure logic, an inseparable concatenation of a chain of logic as tight as it can be made. And it begins, though, it begins on a fact that does not have to be proven. Romans chapter 1, I believe it's about verse 17, along in there, it says, when Paul starts his logic, his reasoning there, and he works it out through chapter 11. But he says this, the wrath of God is presently and continually being revealed from the skies against men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. He says, that's a fact we don't have to prove. Look around you. Can't you see that God is allowing things happening? No, he's doing things. And you want to deny it, and you want to say that, oh, God would never do those kind of things. No, they're happening, and God's sovereign, and I can't explain it. And when the Pharisees came to Jesus, the Jews came to him and said, well, how do you explain this tower falling on these innocent people? How did the Tower of Siloam, how do you explain this bear coming down out of the hills and just ripping to shreds these children? How do you explain that? And Jesus Christ said, He said, if you don't change, same thing could happen to you. He didn't say that these children were killed because they were rotten. He didn't say the blind man was blind because his parents sinned. He said the blind man was blind so that the glory of God may be shown in him. And I don't know why those children were killed, and Jesus Christ didn't tell me. But he did say this, and I do know what I know for sure. You better change your way or the same thing could happen to you, and it could happen at any moment. That's what he said. And he, at that moment, of course, all judgment had not been given to him yet. The Father still had it. Now all that judgment that the Father, God the Father had, has been delegated to God the Son, Jesus Christ, fully God and fully man. He has it. And the book of Hebrews says this. It says, you think things were bad in the Old Testament? He said, what about now? Now that we know the full story, we have seen the record of the Messiah, and you tramp across the blood of the covenant with your feet now, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. It's going to be worse for people now than it was in the Old Testament. People got it the other way around. They think it's going to be easier. God overlooks things. No, he doesn't. And the reason he doesn't overlook things as much now as he did then is because we have the record, the full record. It's all been revealed to us now. And so it's time. It's time to make a decision. Either get it in your head. I'm including myself in these statements. I'm ignorant beyond anything I want to be. I don't know what God wants me to do. I want to find out. And the more I find out, the more I can do what he wants, and the more he is dignified, and the more I enjoy life. That's what he promised me. And it comes down to who is the true lawgiver. Again, back to fundamental things. When I hear these stories on Monday nights about what's going on in the courts, and it was said that these fellows they're suffering. I understand that. They're bewildered. They're confused a little bit. How can this be? Well, it's just a lesson we all learn as we get older. The cruelness of evil and how it infects men. We can't imagine it. We better be on our guard. This is dangerous. We're fighting an ultimate battle here. And the battle is fought against the law of the city and the law of the land, the law of the evil empires and the kingdom of God. That's what this is all about. It's what it's always been about. And now it's ratcheting up right now. Now you can see it. The false law is moving in, Sharia law. Oh, it's in Europe. It's in England. It's in France. Look what's going on in France. That's all about conflict of laws. And there's going to be war and battle. There's killing going on right now because they cannot agree on an objective standard whereby to govern their country. Some people say, oh, we want to do what the Islamic people say and let them rape the girls, beat up old men. And they like that. Pedophilia, rape, domination. That's all part of Islam. We must come to grips with the facts. Either we do or we don't. If we do, we live. If we don't, we die. And there's a vacuum of law. And God said, I've given you a standard. Jesus Christ said, if you love me, do what I tell you to do. Obey my commandments. To quote him, this is the love of God, said John the Apostle. We keep his commandments. Is it the love of God that we feel lovable toward people? No. Nice if we do. I like it. I feel lovable toward my children, and I want them to feel that way toward me, to have natural affection. But that's just natural affection. Animals have natural affection. I watch hogs and cattle and horses and chickens and kittens, and they have that. They love their young. They'll protect them. They'll kill for them. Men and women have that too, but there's a greater love than that. That's just in the flesh. That's natural. God says, this is my love, that you do what I tell you to do. You have to learn it first. The book of Hebrews, or the book of Deuteronomy, says there are three things I want you to do. I want you to, number one, learn the law of God. Number two, I want you to keep the law of God. That means do not add to it, do not subtract from it. Safeguard. Number three, I want you to do it. Three verbs. Each one of them is different. And if men, it's important that women, of course, can profit from this, but the state of our country and our people depends upon men doing these things. And if men do not do these things, there will be no change. Because men, the male of our species, is the one that is responsible for getting us into this situation where we are in darkness. Adam did that, our grandpa. And men have been doing it ever since. The Bible says that. I'm not making this up. I'm just reporting what it says. And so we are responsible to do what's right. I've said enough, and I've repeated myself more than I needed to probably, but thanks for the question.
Hey, I was just enjoying your sermon there for a couple minutes. I was like, yes, keep going, preacher.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. I can't hear anybody saying amen, but
I was about to there a couple moments. But
okay. Well, I'm glad people agree, but what I hope is that people that have not yet been persuaded heretofore are persuaded that the problem is people say, well, people got to get saved. Well, people do. I mean, if people they go to hell if God doesn't make them safe. When we say save them. But God, Jesus Christ said, I come to give you life. That's eternal salvation. But he said, then I come to give it to you also more abundantly. And the Bible is replete from one end to the other that the more abundant life men may have, the enjoyment of life, comes by knowing, keeping, and doing what God has said. That's where abundance comes. That's where our families are held together. That's where we have prosperity of wealth. That's where we have fulfillment, the purpose. All those things, just by saying, what is your purpose? My purpose? Jesus Christ said, my food, the old translation says my meat. That's an old word for food. My food is to do the will of him that sent me. I would rather do that than eat when I'm hungry. He proved that, by the way. He went without food for 40 days. If we ever get that way, then things will change. And by the way, if the rest of the country doesn't get that way, if you get that way, life becomes worth living. I can tell you for sure. But if that is not your purpose, you will disappoint, and discourage. That's all you'll get out of it.
Well, I'm glad my question gave you your second voice.
Well, thank you. Well, nice to hear from Missouri.
Listen, you talk about the sheriff and how they get addicted to this money, which is absolutely true. And they say, well, we'll just elect our own sheriff. Well, and that's much easier said than done because, you know, everybody's hooked to this money. So basically what you're saying, Brent, is that if the people don't change themselves, this system will never change. Because, we had one of our fellows, Robert Overjule, ran for sheriff. And he ran against a guy that was pretty constitutional, and he ended up becoming friendly with him. So Robert didn't win. He did a pretty good job. But he's still friends with the guy, and there's a dialogue there. Now, I don't know how much this guy has at his hand to not take federal money. You see, if the people in the county have been sold that bill of goods, telling them it's going to lower their taxes and all this other stuff, if people won't pull the lever of a constitutional sheriff because he's not going to make them money, then we're dead in the water. So basically, we have to things won't change until we educate ourselves. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you think you're going to change your local government, you better be in a small place because, like in New York City, there's no political, until they get so they're not eating and drinking or something like that, that's the only thing that's going to change those people. They got to be starving before they'll think about changing their party vote, if you know what I mean. Because there's that entrenched. Just like John was talking about, there's a certain mindset amongst professionals, especially, you know, we see it a lot with lawyers, and you see it with doctors too, and they have a sort of tunnel vision because there's a certain schooling they received, and their minds have been closed. You know, you have to learn how to unlearn before you can relearn. You see, when things change to a point where there's a paradigm shift, and it goes against everything that you've been taught, you have to learn how to unlearn that. That's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what Samuel Clemens said. He said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you as so much. He said, it's what you think is so. It's what you think you know that ain't so. That's what gets you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're running off and you're making decisions based on what? False information, right?
Mm-hmm.
So until we can, and I think this has to be a grassroots thing, and it's going to come from the smaller communities, because I think we cannot control the big population centers politically. The only way you're going to control a big population center politically is when there's hunger and strife, and a charismatic guy gets up, and hopefully somebody will preach the truth, and he won't, you know, that's how the Antichrist will come in too. He'll use that strife and give them a solution, which they always sell us the solution to the problem that they created, and that's the problem. So, it's not going to be easy to get good sheriffs, but if your community has had enough of the baloney and enough people are educated, you can do it. But that's going to be a minority of those communities. And look, we should be looking to uphold those. If you find communities around the nation where you have a constitutional sheriff who's actually holding up to the law and not taking federal money and not kowtowing, I would move there tomorrow. We should all move there. We should look to establish those communities.
I thought I had one, guys, but I found out different, which is what caused me to ask the question I have, and I think you both are giving me the answers I need. It's still up to we the people, you know, but only as we're looking to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, as you say, Brent. That really is the key, and our responsibility to obey those laws. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I read a book, and it talked about this French philosopher that came over here about 60 years after the Constitution, and America had made great strides. I think his name was something like Tocqueville or Tocquet. I always pronounce it wrong. But he said the thing that made America great wasn't its amber waves of grains and its big ports or its steel industry or this. He said what he saw was the fact that every pulpit in America was on fire with the words of God bless, you know, one nation under God. And that's what was going on back then. That's not what's going on today. And I think that's the difference. You know, so everybody said, well, the church age is dead. Well, they got 501(c)s, they're corporatized, they're deathly dead. I wouldn't go into a 501(c) church if you dragged me with freaking, with wild, you know, horses. But, and I mean, I understand they don't understand what's going on because they were spoon-fed this, and they didn't realize the evil that they were biting onto. They didn't realize that they were selling their soul to this devil. But, and so, I mean, they're doing it in a certain ignorance. However, it serves its purpose, and it's worked its work. You know, anybody that wants to be a pastor or minister to people, you could still do that. I think that men need to gather and to pray. That's what we're commanded to do. So don't just say the church age is dead. Guess what? Get yourself somebody that really knows how to preach, that really knows the principles of God. And meet there and do that and rebuild that thing, because that's the only way it's going to happen. That's kind of like what the Committee of Safety has to fill, that gap right there, you know. And you know, we have to operate that. We have to bring that into the courtroom. We have to bring that law back into the court. So now, you know, the judge's bench and that court is the pulpit. If you can get in there and you can operate it and run it, then that's how you reinstitute it, is what I can see. But it has to be from the people first. It's not going to go in there until it's in our hearts, you know, until we re-educate people. And I don't know how long that's going to take, or if it's even possible, or whatever, or I don't know, or maybe there'll only be a few communities. I often thought that America would end up the balkanization, where you have certain areas that are good and certain areas that are bad. That's kind of what I see in America's future right now, that if people band together in certain communities and reinstitute this law, that they will be able to hold it together, because you can't do it. No man's an island, and you know what I mean? So the social beings that we are and what it's going to take, I don't know that the whole nation is going to straighten out. Not unless there's great death and destruction, I think, and not many people come out, you know. It's unfortunate, but anyway.
Well, also, not everybody, whenever I get on and I get animated and I talk, and I don't know that what I'm doing necessarily is what's going to move the people that need to be moved. What I think really moves people, ultimately, well, there's a necessity for somebody that maybe gets animated like I do sometimes, but people quietly just saying, no, I ain't going there. Just quietly saying, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going this far. I'm not going any further. No, you're wrong. That isn't the way to do it. No, you shouldn't be taking that federal money. You know, when you speak like, as they say, words whispered in the ear go in deeper than ones shouted. The ones that are shouted just bounce off. And sometimes we, in the forums we have, there's a place for oratory and louder talk, but and more animated talk. But what really then ultimately the next step is for people to just say, here's where the law is, and I'm not going along with you anymore. And when a critical mass of folk do that, then there could be a change.
Well, you know what? I'll give you an example, Brent, of something that happened over here in my community, and I sort of dropped the ball on it. I spoke to my sheriff. I knew him pretty well because he was running for office when I was running, and I got to know him. And I went to see him one day, and I told him, I said, you know, these federal monies that they offer you, I said, if you take them, they come with strings attached. He says, I know it. And he says, the trouble is, he says, the legislators tie my purse strings because they don't want to give us the money. They want me to take the federal loan so they can use that money elsewhere. So I get stuck to take it to do anything. And I said, well, you know what we need to do? I said, look, there's federal grants all over this county for all kinds of stupid things. I said, what we need to do is have a resolution in this county that the county, that these legislators have to fund the sheriff's office out of the tax money first before they give to anything else out there, anything. And then they fund the sheriff's office first so that we can have an independent constitutional sheriff's office. And then anybody else that needs federal grants, let them go beg to the federal government. Because that's how they're controlling our local police force. We don't have a local police force. What you end up with is you end up, like you said, with a federal police force. Look, if the marshals are controlling the sheriff, then the federal government is controlling your county. And that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
So the rest of the story is they come out with the federal government, you can go on their site, and they show every county and what they took in federal thing. Like they show, we sent an MRAP over here and these guns over there and this stuff over there. And I looked up my county, and we took nothing. So I said, he listened, you know. But I don't know that he didn't take any federal money at all, but he certainly didn't take any federal stuff like, you know, military equipment or anything that the federal – actually, I think it said he got no dollars that year. So, I mean, I know we've received federal dollars before for different things, you know, but, you know, that year there was nothing listed on the federal register that came to my county. So sometimes you think you're not making a difference. Now, I need to go back and push this business of funding the sheriff's office first to keep it independent. And right now we have this SAFE Act where they want everybody to register their guns with the state police, basically taking it out of the sheriff's department where it sits now. So taking more authority away and giving it to basically the governor's private police force, who is the state troopers, because that's who they answer to. They answer to the governor, basically.
Yep.
So, you know, and why should they have a list of who has the guns? What do they need it for?
The
sheriff is the elected law enforcement official in the county. He's supposed to be the top law enforcement officer. You know, he should not be laying down to the state police. So if you had a sheriff, you see, but how's the sheriff going to stand up to the state police if he's taking federal money?
Yep.
It's not going to happen. So these are just some of the thoughts that I have about, you know, what to do with the sheriff and how to fund him and all that stuff. But I don't, like I said, I don't have the answer, just like you don't have the answer. But together, we bang our heads together here every Monday night, and things come out, and maybe we make an effect, and maybe we get a sheriff or, you know, or a county or something. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
One city at a time. So that's the good part of this, where we put our heads together and try to come up to solutions and educate people and make other people's juices flow so they can come up with their own creative idea. Look at Crystal. She's an elderly woman, and she's in those courts. It's just being a burr under her saddles. God bless her, you know? You know, who's the injured part? Asking these little questions that we're too afraid to ask, right, in open court. Who are you? I'm the trustee. Who do you represent? Well, I represent you. Oh, well, there you go. Right? I mean, who does that? That's what we need to be doing. Of course, you know, sometimes you don't have the wherewithal to do that until you get over 50, 60, and you get to this point where you get tired of taking other people's baloney, and you become a grumpy old man like me and probably you, Brent, and you just have more stuff that you wouldn't have said 20 years ago, right?
Yeah,
We all need to be doing that. We all need to be voicing, you know, and again, the truth will prevail if only somebody proclaims it. If we're not proclaiming it, it's not going to prevail. And with that, I think it's almost like 12 o'clock.
Yeah, it is.
It's a bewitching hour.
Yeah.
So thank you, everybody. And I'm going to close it down. I don't know if anybody didn't get in early next week, and we'll take your questions. And we had a good call, a lot of subject matter here. We could probably go on all night, but I got to get going. Okay.
Me too. Thanks, Gerard.
Have a good night. Thank you, Brent. Thank you, John, and everybody else.